to avoid becoming a victim yourself.
That's a horrible place to be in, because then you feel like you've got nowhere to turn.
Five Ways They Get You on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday at 11:45.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 20th of November. This is Today with Emma Barnett in London and Nick Robinson in Bulgaria at Kapitan Andreevo, the border checkpoint between Turkey, Bulgaria and Greece, the busiest land border in Europe, where we're speaking to people trying to make the crossing over that border and those that are trying to stop them doing it. Hands up if you came here with a people smuggler and it was easy to get over the border from Turkey to Bulgaria. There's a lot of people nodding yes.
Yes. Be interested to hear more of that. Good morning here from London. It's a chilly one, of course. We'll get to the weather a bit later, but the headlines today: President Biden has given the go-ahead for Ukraine to be supplied with anti-personnel mines in the war against Russia in a second major defence policy change. And the government says it will make the online safety bill tougher if it doesn't see tech companies doing enough to protect people using their sites.
Also in today's programme, from here at Europe's busiest land crossing border, the frontier between the EU and the rest of the world, we've got rare access to the border police in Bulgaria, who are trying to stop the boats which are made in Turkey before they can reach the channel. And as the first winter snow falls across parts of the country, Michael Morpurgo captures the childhood thrill in a poem, especially for us.
Maybe you were playing in it on the way to school. Maybe you went on the snow slide in the playground. Your noses and your fingers were all frozen. Think about the snowman you built, the snowball fights you had in the park, maybe on the way home, rolling down that hill, all the fun of it.
All that after the BBC News, read this morning by Jane Steele.
President Biden has approved the supply of anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine in another marked shift in policy in the final weeks of his time in office. Officials said Kiev had agreed not to use them in built-up areas. Washington had only just authorised the use of its long-range missiles to strike deep into Russia, which Ukraine has already deployed. Our North America correspondent John Sudworth reports from Washington.
A US official confirmed to the BBC that Ukraine would be supplied with what it's long been asking for, anti-personnel mines to impede the advance of Russian troops. It's a significant change in policy. 2 years ago, the Biden administration committed to limit the export of such weapons because of concerns about the long-lasting risk to civilian populations. The US official said the mines supplied would be non-persistent, meaning they're designed to degrade over much shorter timescales. The decision follows another big change, the permission to fire US-made missiles into Russia, which Ukraine acted upon almost immediately, striking an ammunition store some 70 miles outside its borders.
The man appointed as the UK's first border security commander has defended his role and expressed optimism that real progress can be made in stopping people smugglers. In his first broadcast interview since taking up the job in September, Martin Hewitt told this programme there was no simple answer to the problem, but the first step was to attack the smugglers' business model. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent Dominic Casciani.
The former police chief said the UK had to project its border beyond the English coast and northern France and take the fight to the organised crime gangs moving people and boats across Europe. He promised to chip away at the criminal business model until it was no longer profitable, a tactic used widely against organised crime. The former Conservative Home Secretary, James Cleverly, has accused Labour of making up a job that already existed, but Mr Hewitt said that the meetings he was now chairing, involving every relevant branch of government and law enforcement, were the first time they'd all been working collectively together.
You can hear the full interview at 8:30. A report has found that children in England as young as 11 are carrying knives because they feel unsafe, with serious youth violence now widespread. The joint study was carried out by Ofsted, the Care Quality Commission and the Police Fire and Probation Inspection Bodies. The research also found that children with special educational needs and disabilities were disproportionately at risk of harm. The government has made clear it is prepared to make the online safety bill tougher if tech companies don't do enough to protect users of their platforms. The legislation comes into force fully next spring. The Technology Secretary, Peter Kyle, says he wants the regulator Ofcom to be more assertive with firms and report back on what action has been taken. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Peter Kyle lists five key areas for Ofcom to prioritise. This includes collecting evidence that tech firms are embedding safety features such as age verification tools into their platforms designed to protect children and minimise the spread of illegal content and disinformation. But Ofcom itself will not safety test products before they're released. Mr. Kyle also calls for the regulator to be prepared to tackle emerging harms such as the rise of AI-generated material, and said he would consider strengthening the Online Safety Act in the future if he found it was needed. Some critics have argued that the current legislation does not go far enough.
The US Special Envoy Amos Hochstein has expressed hope that an end to the war between Israel and Hezbollah is now within grasp. He's held talks in Beirut about a ceasefire plan, which has been largely endorsed by Lebanon and Hezbollah. But the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said military operations against Hezbollah would continue even if a ceasefire was reached. The NHS has set up a blood testing programme to detect potentially dangerous viruses that could spread to the UK because of climate change. Thousands of samples will be screened over the coming months for diseases including West Nile virus, which are normally found in hotter areas of the world. Here's our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
With global warming and increased international travel and trade, mosquitoes are pushing further north into Europe. The species capable of spreading West Nile virus has recently been found in southern England, raising the potential risk of an infection there. There have been no human cases in the UK yet, nor of another virus called Usutu found in birds. But officials at the UK Health Security Agency have identified these two viruses, plus another in ticks, as potential emerging infections in the coming decades.
The latest flight of the SpaceX Starship rocket has taken place in Texas, with President-elect Donald Trump joining Elon Musk to watch the launch. But hopes of repeating the success of the last mission were dashed when the rocket splashed down in the Gulf of Mexico instead of returning to the launch tower. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
There are so many things that have to be exactly right to successfully catch a rocket booster the size of a 20-storey building, slowing down from supersonic speed at the launch tower. For the catch to be tried, flight engineers have to give a verbal go for both the tower and the booster. There was a go for the tower, so initial indications suggest that the issue was with the booster section. The flight team followed procedures and sent it for a safe splashdown in the Gulf of Mexico.
The tennis career of the former men's world number one Rafael Nadal has come to an end after Spain were beaten by the Netherlands in the quarterfinals of the Davis Cup. Had Spain won the tie, there was a chance that Nadal may have got to play again. After his defeat in his last match, he reflected on his final time on court.
The emotions, feeling the national anthem for the last time like a professional have been, you know, very special. And then, of course, a little bit of mixed feelings makes the things a little bit more difficult.
Rafael Nadal speaking there.
Jane, thanks very much. And at 8 minutes past six, let's get the latest on that weather. I'm presuming it's going to be a chilly one, Simon King, at the BBC Weather Centre. I'm already feeling it.
Yeah, absolutely, Emma. Yeah, wrap up warmly this morning. Yeah, very cold, very frosty and potentially pretty icy for some parts this morning. So some hazards to be aware of this morning if you are travelling and setting outside. There are also some further winter showers. Some of you may be waking up to a fresh covering of snow this morning as well. Let's start off in southwest, southeast and eastern England, where we've got a few rain showers in Cornwall and Devon today. Otherwise, though, it's cold and frosty with the risk of ice on untreated surfaces. Some areas of cloud, but lots of sunshine developing for most of the day. The exception to that will be the far east of England. Some winter showers coming off the North Sea, particularly windy around those coasts as well. Temperatures 1 to 4 degrees Celsius, but locally 6 to 8 degrees in the far southwest. For Wales and the Midlands, a widespread frost. Temperatures minus 2 to minus 5 degrees first thing. Some winter showers coming in across North Wales and into the Midlands. Snow over higher ground, but even down to low levels, there is some snow falling at the moment. Otherwise, some hail, sleet, and a bit of of rain mixed into. Winter showers continuing for North Wales all day, but sunshine developing elsewhere, 1 to 4 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, a frosty and icy start today. Lots of sunshine though for most of the day. A few winter showers in northeast England, snow over the North York Moors, highs of 1 to 4. And for Northern Ireland, quite cloudy, so not quite as cold here. Temperatures about freezing at the moment. Winter showers at times, highs of 3 to 5 degrees. And Scotland, frequent snow coming in again across northern, western and eastern coastal areas. Otherwise a sunny day and temperatures freezing to 3 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It's coming up to 10 past 6. It's positively balmy here. Sorry to rub it in the Bulgaria-Turkey border. We're broadcasting this morning from the biggest border crossing in Europe, the second largest border crossing in the world. It's called Capitan Andreevo, and it is the main frontier between the EU and the world beyond. Not just Turkey, right across this border, Syria, Iran and Iraq beyond, Georgia and Azerbaijan too. And each year, more than 1 million lorries cross here, more than 2 million cars. We're here because the Bulgarian government want to show off their ability to control Europe's external border and its ability to search for migrants trying to cross it illegally, and critically for us, the boats that are used on those channel crossings, 90% of which are manufactured in Turkey. I was shown the effort to intercept those boats by a Bulgarian customs officer called Valery Stajkov. He showed me one inflatable that his team had seized.
We detained 113 boats like this.
So let's take a look at this. This is an inflatable, which is what?
Like 15 meters.
And it's very crude, isn't it?
Yes.
This is just a very simple inflatable rib. And at the back, an engine, what, 30 horsepower?
Yes, exactly.
Which you would use on the back of a craft for two or three people in Britain. And this will take how many?
I guess more than 50.
Now, it is not illegal to sell those outboards or indeed to sell inflatable boats. After all, they could, in theory at least, be used for pleasure trips or to go fishing. But in the past year, Bulgaria's changed the rules so that only a few companies in Turkey are now licensed to sell them and to carry them over this border. The people smuggling gangs have reacted, trying to hide them or pretend they're something else, putting on the papers for customs that they are a children's bouncy castle, for example. If someone is found breaking the rules, it is not a crime. It's a breach of those customs regulations, and they're fined €2,000 per boat. Given so much money can be made in people smuggling, about that much, just for one person to cross the channel, I asked the customs officer, what would stop them coming back again and again and again and simply paying those fines from their profits?
That's for sure. Nobody says we stop everything here, but we tried hard.
They try hard with the help of Britain. Britain's trained a sniffer dog that can detect rubber, a dog you'll hear later in the programme called Adele. Can't sing, sadly, Emma, but can certainly smell out rubber boats. And it is used as a demonstration of what can be achieved through international cooperation. You also see here the limits of that, though. Atanas Rusev spoke to me. He runs a Bulgarian think tank in Sofia, and he's an expert in border security.
If you think that you can stop these irregular flows just for policing and prosecution and securitizing, it's a road to nowhere.
Why does he say that? Well, proof comes at Bulgaria's biggest refugee camp, which is in a town called Harmanli, about 45 minutes from here, home to almost 1,000 refugees. When I visited the camp, I was quickly surrounded by a group of young Syrian men, all of whom had managed to overcome or evade the fearsome-looking border fence between Bulgaria and Turkey, the patrols, the cameras, the drones, with the help of people smugglers who know how to make it over the border into the EU and who charge a pretty price for doing so. Did you see the police?
Hel shuftum shurta?
No police.
No police?
No police.
So you pay the smugglers, you climb over the fence, but you don't see the police?
Police, no. No
police. The smugglers are very well organized. They know the land very well, so everything goes smoothly once you pay them.
No one who works with the migrants here, no one who works on border security, would ever use the sort of phrases that politicians routinely use about migration. Not for them phrases like stop the boats or smash the gangs. What they talk about instead is a much more modest ambition. Making the journey harder so that fewer people try. Making crime harder too. They all accept, though, that those who really want to make it from one side of the border to the other will probably eventually succeed.
At 14 minutes past six, let's turn our attention then to the war in Ukraine and Moscow's threat of nuclear retaliation after Ukraine fired US long-range rockets into Russia for the first time, as well as President Joe Biden's approval of anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine. Sarah Rainsford, our Eastern Europe correspondent, is in Warsaw. Sarah, as many are putting it, a dramatic escalation on the, as it was yesterday, 1,000th day of war.
Well, dramatic changes from the US administration, from Joe Biden in the last weeks and months of his presidency, and what is meant as a dramatic response, or certainly a dramatic warning from Russia, because I don't think the signing of the nuclear doctrine by Vladimir Putin, the timing of that, I don't think was accidental, of course. It was meant to send a signal to the West, to be a warning that there could be a very, very worrying retaliation if what Russia is calling an escalation by Ukraine's Western allies continues. Of course, it isn't an escalation by Ukraine's Western allies. This is a response to a war of aggression and invasion of Ukraine. And of course, Joe Biden is pointing, and his administration are pointing quite clearly to the fact that there are now North Korean troops inside Russia assisting and fighting alongside the Russian military, and that Russia has been using Iranian, North Korean and other weaponry for a long time now. So I think it's quite clear that Russia is attempting to frighten Western allies of Ukraine off increasing assistance. But it's not only missiles we're seeing being approved for use now. We've now heard that landmines, anti-personnel landmines, will be provided to Ukraine, which is something new. Certainly, it's something that Joe Biden had resisted until now.
What do we know about those? For people who are not familiar, what does anti-personnel landmines mean?
Well, it means it gives Ukrainian forces the chance to use them in frontline areas. They've apparently agreed to use them away from populated areas to stop the advance of Russian troops. Because, of course, we know that is the problem at the moment. As Ukraine tries to push back Russian forces and Russian forces are advancing, those landmines are supposed, the American administration says, to blunt that advance. So it's another tool, I suppose, in the armory of Ukrainian forces. An attempt to help them, because all the talk now is turning towards the possibility that Ukraine and Russia will have ultimately to sit down and to talk. The worry that Donald Trump, of course, is going to try to resolve this conflict quickly and potentially not to Ukraine's advantage. So I think it looks like the Joe Biden administration is trying to help Ukraine in every way he possibly can, but right in the tail end of his presidency, right at the last minute, and in some pretty controversial ways. The use of landmines is pretty controversial with many people. And as I say, it's something Joe Biden had resisted until now. They're underlining that these are mines that will basically self-destruct when their battery runs out. So they're saying that the non-persistent kind of landmines, but nevertheless, there is controversy about their use.
There is, and discussion of that today continues. Sarah Rainsford, our Eastern Europe correspondent, thank you.
It is 18 minutes past six now. Let's turn to a look at what's making the front pages. They carry warnings of an increasing nuclear threat from President Putin after the Russian president approved new rules for Russia's military. Putin clears way for nuclear strike, declares the Daily Mail's headline after Ukraine fired US long-range rockets into Russia for the first time. The paper calls it a dramatic escalation on the 1,000th day of the conflict.
Moving to the Times, which says Vladimir Putin has raised the nuclear stakes by lowering the legal threshold for using atomic weapons in retaliation for those attacks on its territory with Western-supplied weapons that we were just hearing about from Sarah. The paper says Mr. Putin has been weighing up altering his nuclear doctrine for several months.
President Putin has ramped up fears of nuclear war, is the way the Mirror reports the story. It labels him a tyrant. And in a comment piece, the Mirror says the Russian leader invaded his neighbour in a bloodthirsty land grab. Now the victim he's pummeling is fighting back with US-supplied weapons.
And The Guardian reports that the United States is incredibly concerned about what it calls a Russian hybrid warfare campaign against the West. According to the paper, people briefed on discussions about Russia's likely response say that potential hybrid attacks could include expanding its campaign of sabotage and assassinations in Europe or further arming US adversaries in the Middle East and Indo-Pacific.
There is other news on the front pages. The farmers' inheritance tax protest in London makes it there. The Telegraph carries a large photo of Jeremy Clarkson, who owns a farm, talking to the media, who's one of the high-profile supporters to join thousands of farmers at Westminster. The Mail calls it the day Clarkson's farmer army parked on Starmer's lawn. They spent some time working that headline out, didn't they? The paper says protesting farmers have warned that this is just the warm-up against what it calls the government's inheritance tax raid.
And keeping with that story, the Times reports that Labour MPs have privately warned that the plans to raise inheritance tax risk hitting the average farmer rather than the intended target. As the paper puts it, they are non-farmers buying swathes of agricultural land to avoid inheritance tax, the actual target. The government have been saying that it will only really be farms worth £3 million which are affected in most cases. But if you go to the Metro front page, it has it as Farmageddon.
First-class stamps are now so expensive it can be cheaper to fly to Europe to post your Christmas cards, according to the Telegraph. It says that Royal Mail's decision to raise the price to £1.65 means that sending a letter from some countries abroad costs half as much as sending it domestically. Analysis found that six foreign destinations where posting 100 cards would be cheaper than in Britain, even when including the cost of a return flight. For instance, sending 100 cards from Belgrade to the UK would cost £78. Flights from Luton to the Serbian capital can cost as little as £33, a total of £111, still much less than the £165 the postage would cost in the UK. So if you happen to have 100 friends that you want to send postcards to or Christmas cards to in Serbia, the Telegraph has given you the solution to your problems.
Well, I still love letter writing, so I hope people really appreciate it now with what we know, that you could fly away for the same price or less. At 21 minutes past six, who better then to hear from the man who knows about business and can make these comparisons for us, but we're not going to ask you to do maths on the fly about stamps. The bosses of Ford, Vauxhall and Nissan are among those meeting ministers later with the aim of getting the government to relax its rules on EVs, but car makers are not the only businesses affected. Will Bain, good morning.
Morning, Emma. Yeah, no, that's right. And I think I'll leave the personal finance to the personal finance expert. So I'm thinking about the personal finance of my own house for later as we get closer to
Fair
Christmas,
enough.
Of course. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. This EV mandate, it's the zero emission vehicle target, dictates the percentage of car manufacturer sales that must be zero emission vehicles by 2035. It scales up over the years. 22% this year, goes right up to 100%, as you say, by 2035. And a number of the industry leaders, including the likes of Nissan and Stellantis, which owns Vauxhall and Citroen, are going to be among those speaking to ministers about that target today, saying the UK car industry has reached crisis point and that they're likely to miss many of those targets. Well, Clive Selley is chief executive of Openreach, the subsidiary of BT that constructs broadband infrastructure and has the largest commercial van fleet in the UK, around 4,500 of which are EVs. Clive, morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Will.
So this mandate then presumably has a big impact on the type of vehicles that you guys are using to get your staff out to work on the broadband network right around the UK.
Yeah, our core mission, Will, is the construction of a full fibre broadband network for the people and the businesses of the UK. That's a massive investment, about £15 billion. To do that, we deploy 25,000 engineers in large vans across the UK. So 25,000 vans, 4,500 of which are now electric vehicles. We've paid to install 3,000 home chargers for our engineering staff. So going green by 2031 is the plan. We want to eliminate all internal combustion engine vans by that date. So we are very keen that industry and government collaborates to continue producing as many EVs as possible, particularly in the UK. And we're also very keen that they acknowledge the barriers to adoption. So, you know, talking to my own engineers, it's very clear that their biggest bugbear here is the public EV charging infrastructure in the UK, which is insufficient and it's unreliable. So we'd love them to focus on the barriers to driving higher demand from the people of the UK for EV adoption.
Is this target or these series of targets, is it useful to that end then?
I think it is useful to keep the pressure up on adoption. You know, we will not be able to buy internal combustion engine vans by 2035. So as a very big fleet operator, we have to face into that and we have to learn early the issues of EV ownership, figure out how to persuade our own people that EVs are good for them and not a problem because of range or other issues. So having targets is not unhelpful.
The argument the car makers are making, and actually we heard it from the boss of Europe Car, who we had on the programme last week, saying that it doesn't matter where the target is, but everybody's got to go to it at the same time. And if the car makers are saying actually they can't meet this target, does it not make sense to look at it again, that one that you can all move towards together?
Yes, I think we do all have to move together, and collaboration is the key, and identifying the barriers to adoption. You know, what the car makers are saying is that demand has softened. So we need to understand why has it softened and tackle those barriers. And I think public charging infrastructure is one of those issues. Perhaps the subsidy on EV purchase is another one. People are not convinced that that will be maintained. The tax on EVs, there are news stories suggesting that the tax advantage on EV ownership will be diluted in some way. These are all barriers to adoption, and we need to work on those together.
But do you think having a target kind of pushes people, prompts people to do that, and that actually the closer that target is, the quicker some of those things might happen?
Yeah, I agree on that. We have a target. It is 2031, and everybody at Openreach is focused on eliminating internal combustion engine vans by 2031. That focuses the mind.
Clive, thanks so much for your time this morning. Now, that's Clive Selly, the Chief Executive of Openreach. Well, Louise Dudley is with us, Portfolio Manager, Global Equities at Federated Hermes, to look at some of the other stories that are moving financial markets this morning. Louise, morning.
Good morning.
And we heard from the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, yesterday, ahead of course, we're going to get inflation data from the ONS at 7 o'clock this morning. And he was talking about the potential impact, something we were talking about on the programme, that the changes to employers' national insurance that the British Retail Consortium was flagging.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, overall, the UK growth outlook is being helped by some of the cuts that we're seeing to interest rates, but the inflation rate, and we'll see what that number comes in at seven, it is going to be important for businesses and how they price their products going forward, how they're able to take on board some of these higher labour costs that are going to impact their businesses.
As I say, we'll be talking about those numbers once they are out after 7 o'clock this morning. Let's turn to companies news, Louise. Mulberry, the fashion retailer, are looking to rebuild its business. It said it had some pretty poor results.
Yeah, so year on year, the numbers were pretty weak, kind of led by the sales numbers that were weak, but also earnings came in as well. But we do have a new CEO and, you know, saying all the right things in terms of streamlining operations, improving margins. But they are a business that does get about 15% of their revenue from Asia. And with the, you know, tariffs that might be impacting some of these businesses, I think it's going to be difficult for them. There's also, you know, a lot of uncertainty for consumers as well. So that consumer confidence, whether people want to go out and spend a lot of money on an expensive bag, if they're worried about kind of bottom line, then they're not going to go out and do that. So a bit of a challenge, and certainly the share price has been weak. And so the company has been subject to kind of potential takeover bids as well. So that's, again, something else that management will have to deal with potentially going forward.
Interesting. I guess the story that potentially could dominate financial markets today, Louise, is the Department of Justice in the United States looking at Google. We're going to hear what steps it's going to take next after it accused Google of operating an online search monopoly. We heard yesterday, didn't we, from Google, pretty furious about the ideas that seem to have been leaked to Bloomberg that splitting off the Chrome browser might be one of those sort of remedies.
Yeah, and we'll wait and see today what actually kind of comes through. Actually, the next kind of point in time will be in April next year. So Trump will already be in, whether these things actually kind of come to pass, as it were. But certainly a negative for Alphabet, Google, the Google parent. And if they're no longer able to kind of put these areas of their business together at the moment, they make a lot of their revenues from selling ads associated with Chrome. And at the moment, you know, they're looking to their new AI powered search engine, Gemini. And at the moment, you know, they're looking to grow that business. If that's kind of cut short for them, then it's going to be a big impact to their earnings going forward.
Louise, thanks so much for your time. Louise Dudley, Portfolio Manager at Global Equities at Federated Hermes. Well, someone who's watching this pretty closely is Bill Kovacic. Bill is the Global Competition Professor of Law and Policy at George Washington University and a former member of the US competition regulator, the Federal Trade Commission. He's joining us live from Washington, D.C., so staying up pretty late for us there. Bill, thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure, thank you.
Is the DOJ really going to suggest that Google flogs Chrome today?
I think so. I think that we're going to get a menu of options that range from simply prohibiting the conduct that was identified as improper in the judge's decision, additional remedies that might require access to data sets that Google has. But the boldest approach would be some form of divestiture, and Chrome, the divestiture of Chrome might be part of it. So we're going to see a menu of options offered to the judge, ranging from milder, simply stop the behavior, to more serious intervention in the form of a divestiture.
Is that really what consumers want?
I think we'll know a lot more about that in the proceeding that Louise referred to in April. We're going to have probably the most remarkable proceeding on remedies that we've seen in the United States. And that will be a detailed discussion about what happens if you do divest Chrome. That will involve testimony from business executives, from technical specialists, from academics who've studied divestitures in the past. It's going to be a particularly informative window into how Google operates and how a divestiture would affect its operations in the future.
This would be an enormous step, Bill. I presume the timeline is pretty long here. Google would have the right to appeal?
They would. The judge has promised that he will issue his decision on remedy by the end of August 2025. There's an inevitability of an appeal to the intermediate appellate court that would probably take about a year to 15 months to resolve. That takes us out to the end of 2026. I think this case has a visit with the Supreme Court written all over it. Add another year, and we get a final resolution sometime at the end of 2027.
Bill Kovacic, Global Competition Professor of Law and Policy at George Washington University. Thanks so much for your time. And as I say, we'll be back after 7 o'clock picking through that latest inflation data from the ONS. But now it's time for the sports news, and Mike Williams has got that.
Will, thank you. Good morning. Let's start with football, shall we? Because it was quite the night in Cardiff.
Wilson takes over.
If you can make out the commentary against that cacophony in Cardiff, then you've got better hearing than me. But that was the sound of Wales celebrating a surprise promotion to the top tier of European football's Nations League last night. They came from behind to beat Iceland 4-1 thanks to Swansea City striker Liam Cullen's first two international goals. It means Wales manager Craig Bellamy remains unbeaten in six matches, with the new boss happy to dispel a few misconceptions about him along the way.
Probably feel it was important to show people that, like, I'm not a lunatic. I'm quite sane. People think I was going to be, like, running on the pitch and pushing a ref and stuff, and no. Like, you obviously don't know me, but I felt probably more pushed into management to show that.
We'll have more on that performance by Wales in the next hour of the programme. Elsewhere in football, it's being widely reported this morning that Pep Guardiola has signed a contract extension as manager of Manchester City. The Spaniard joined City in 2016 and has won 18 trophies so far, including six Premier League titles. His contract was up at the end of this season, but is now believed to have been extended by 12 months, although City as yet are refusing to comment. Next to Malaga, and it is now officially all over for one of the greats of tennis.
And that is the blow that ends Rafael Nadal's career.
The Dutch win the doubles to knock Spain out of the Davis Cup, and Rafael Nadal watches his last match from the bench. There was not to be a fairy tale ending in Malaga.
Yes, Rafael Nadal is now a former professional tennis player. The 22-time Grand Slam winner has played the final match of his career after his Spain team were beaten by the Netherlands in the Davis Cup quarterfinals.
I can't complain much. I go there, I try my best, I try to enjoy and play with the right energy, with the right attitude. It just didn't work. I lost my first match in the Davis Cup and I lost my last one. So we closed the circle.
Adios, Rafa. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Malaga, Great Britain's chances of reaching their first Billie Jean King Cup final since 1981 are also over, and Kyotovong's team were beaten in the semi-finals yesterday by Slovakia.
Look, right now it's really difficult. It's a tough one to swallow. You know, I really thought we could do it as a team. But overall, you know, I have to maintain positivity for myself and for the team and find a way to pick everyone up. We're all absolutely gutted at the moment.
So Slovakia through to the Billie Jean King Cup final at Great Britain's expense, where they will face the 2023 runners-up Italy later today.
Mike, thanks very much for that.
Take a moment with BBC Radio 3 Unwind, the new destination for music to unwind your mind. Set yourself up for the morning with Dr. Sian Williams' selection of soothing classical tracks. And join Oliver Arnold's as you wind down in the evening with ultimate calm.
Music that can bring complete peace of mind.
Radio 3 Unwind. Listen on BBC Sounds.
I have a confession, I'm rather addicted to Radio 3 Unwind, a lovely way to unwind. Now, we don't want you to unwind just now, we want to wake up for the morning. It's 24 minutes to 7, you're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, with Emma Barnett in the studio in London, me, Nick Robinson, in Bulgaria at the busiest land crossing in Europe. It's time now for a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
President Biden has agreed to give Ukraine anti-personnel landmines only days after allowing Kiev to strike targets inside Russia with American-supplied missiles. This marks another shift in defence policy in the final weeks of his time in office. US officials say Ukraine has committed to use the mines in its own territory and not in built-up areas. The UK's first border security commander has defended his new role, expressing optimism about stopping people smugglers. In his first broadcast interview since taking up the job in September, Martin Hewitt told this programme that he recognised the complexity of the issue but emphasised the need to disrupt the smugglers' business model. A new report says children as young as 11 in England are carrying knives because they feel unsafe. The joint study was carried out by Ofsted, the Care Quality Commission and the Police Fire and Probation Inspection Bodies. The research also found that children with special educational needs and disabilities were disproportionately at risk of serious youth violence. The government has made clear it is prepared to make the online safety bill tougher if tech companies don't do enough to protect users of their platforms. The legislation comes into force fully next spring. The Technology Secretary, Peter Carl, says he wants the regulator Ofcom to be more assertive with firms and report back on what action has been taken. The US Special Envoy Amos Hochstein has expressed hope that an end to the war between Israel and Hezbollah is now within grasp. He's held talks in Beirut about a ceasefire plan, which has been largely endorsed by Lebanon and Hezbollah. But the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said military operations against Hezbollah would continue even if a ceasefire was reached. SpaceX has failed to repeat last month's launch of its Starship rocket, in which it caught the booster section using robotic arms on the launch tower. The chopsticks manoeuvre, as it's called, is vital to developing a cost-saving, fully reusable spacecraft. But the latest test flight, attended by President-elect Donald Trump and Elon Musk in Texas, ended instead with the booster splashing down in the Gulf of Mexico.
Thank you, Jane. It's 22 minutes to 7 now. 90% of the boats used by people smugglers to ferry migrants over the channel are manufactured in Turkey. Many are carried by land into Europe, which means they'll be carried across the biggest border crossing in Europe from where we're broadcasting this morning. You may be able to hear the sound occasionally of the checks of cars and lorries being made outside the window of the office I'm in. It's called Capitan Andreevo. It's the main frontier between the EU and the world beyond, not just Turkey, but Syria, Iran and Iraq, Georgia and Azerbaijan. And it is well known to our Central Europe correspondent, the BBC's Nick Thorpe, who's often been here to report, Nick. And it is interesting that the Bulgarian authorities want to show off what they're doing at this border. It matters hugely, not just to them, but to the EU. What is happening here?
That's right, Nick. Yes, basically where you are, and I'm sure you can see the long lines of trucks and so on. What Bulgaria is hoping is that it will be able to join the EU's Schengen zone along with Romania, which would mean no more border checks across Europe. So that, where you're standing now, would literally become the last big border crossing where people are being checked, having their passports checked and so on. And they're hoping that will happen from January the 1st. Until now, we've had countries like Austria and the Netherlands in particular saying that they're afraid this would increase the migrant flow across that border and eventually, of course, some of those people making for Britain as well. What the Bulgarians and Romanians have been saying all along is, look, we've got all this amazing equipment now. We're doing our level best. We're doing as well as any police force in the world would be able to do. We're actually slowing down or stopping many people from crossing there, and that anyway we would continue to catch people crossing actually within the country, within Bulgaria, just as the Serbian police, the Hungarian police, the Austrian police, the Slovak police and all the other countries in Europe say that a lot of their focus is actually on catching people being caught, being carried by those smuggling gangs across Europe rather than at the borders, which, though, as you're seeing as well, as I know you've been seeing there, have amazing equipment to detect people, for example, hidden away in trucks.
Extraordinary equipment, but as your reporting shows and your documentaries, I think we can get on BBC Sound shows, people do still make it through. We'll hear more about that as the programme progresses. Nick Thorpe, for the moment, thank you.
At 20 to 7, let's turn our attention to Westminster. The tractors may have left that plot of land after yesterday's protest by farmers against inheritance planned changes, tax changes, but the government's turning its attention to tech firms, which could face tougher laws if they fail to protect users better. That's the warning, certainly. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, not dodging tractors this morning, but what we're hearing, what do we know about what the technology secretary, Peter Carley, will be on the programme shortly? What do we know about the pressure he's putting on the media and tech regulator Ofcom today?
This is Peter Carle for the first time activating powers he has under the Online Safety Act that allow him to set strategic priorities for Ofcom. And foremost among them is asking them to be more assertive in their approach to tech firms and social media companies. So he wants them to collect evidence that tech firms are indeed, as they say they are, embedding safety features such as age verification into their platforms. But alongside this, he's also commissioning new research into the effects of smartphones and social media use on children. And that is particularly politically interesting because there is growing pressure in some quarters of the Labour Party that Britain should follow Australia, where their centre-left government has just issued a blanket ban for under-16s using social media. So that is something I expect Peter Carle to face questions on going forwards.
We will ask those questions. In terms of, you know, I mentioned the tractors yesterday, huge amount of anger from many farmers. There's a lot of anger still around the winter fuel payments and what's going on there to this government. I'm also minded of the fact that it's got a lot colder and prices of energy. What is going on with that in terms of the numbers that we know?
And remember, this was a controversial decision that the government made before the budget. It was practically the first decision that Rachel Reeves made as Chancellor. She said she had to do it in order to fill the £22 billion black hole that the government says they inherited from the Conservatives. Yesterday, the government published internal estimates which suggest that at any point over the next 5 years, roughly an additional 50,000 pensioners will be living in relative poverty as a result of this decision on the means testing of the winter fuel payments. Now, crucial caveat, this does not incorporate statistically however many of them might end up receiving pension credit, and the government is urging them to take up pension credit, a campaign for public awareness of the availability of pension credit, which would mean they do receive the winter fuel allowance. And they're also pointing to the increase in the state pension. But politically, when I talk to people in the Labour Party about what worries them about economic decisions the government has made, I think they are more worried by this and how this plays out than they are by farmers for all the sound and fury of yesterday.
Henry Zevman, thank you. Well, at 17 minutes to seven, the government, keeping with moves from those in power, is launching an independent review of physician associates in England, a role first created 20 years ago to support doctors. Why? Hugh Pym, our health editor, is here.
Well, Emma, physician associates do a range of roles supporting doctors under supervision in hospitals and GP practices and in community health settings. They can do initial examinations and collect medical histories. And NHS England wants to greatly boost their number from around 3,000 now in a long-term workforce plan endorsed by the government over a decade to 10,000 or more, designed to take the pressure off doctors and the health service. But there have been increasing criticisms from doctors, a very heated debate. Some are saying they've seen instances of physician associates and anaesthesia associates, they're also covered by this review, doing work that they're not qualified to do and that there are real safety concerns. A coroner recently ruled that a fatality in a hospital of a patient was linked to a PA being involved, and the coroner expressed some concerns about that. So Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, has announced a review to cover England, and he notes that they do provide great care, in his own words, and they do free up doctors, but there are, quotes, legitimate concerns over transparency for patients and scope of practice and the substituting of doctors. And he says there has been a toxic debate where physicians feel ignored and PAs feel demoralised, and therefore this review should be carried out to establish the facts and take the heat out of the issue. And it has become extremely heated. We've heard from physician associates who say they don't want to go on the record because they're worried about a social media backlash. Trusts didn't want to comment about this when we got in touch with them. So I think the hope is it does clear up some of these issues. The BMA, British Medical Association, say it's come not a moment too soon. They've been calling for this for quite a while, but they say PA recruitment should be stalled right now until this review is completed in the spring.
Hugh Pym, our health editor, thank you.
It's 14 minutes to seven now. The headline writers have enjoyed themselves with the scenes in the capital yesterday. We were just hearing about Starmer versus the farmers, as The Guardian puts it, Farmageddon, the Metro. Well, as farmers were gathering in their thousands yesterday at Westminster, the Environment Secretary told them they were wrong to think that so many of them would be affected by new inheritance tax on their farms. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
They came with muddy boots, they came with tractors. One came with a sack of potatoes, as a political statement rather than lunch. But if any group of protesters is equipped to stay outside for hours on the coldest, sleetiest day of the season, it's farmers. Thousands of them were protesting outside Parliament. But a couple of burly lads in check shirts and gilets had come inside to hear the Environment Secretary Steve Reid be questioned about the controversial budget decisions to impose inheritance tax on farms worth more than £1 million. They sat right behind him with their arms folded across their chests as he tried to explain.
I mean, there's a lot of figures flying around at the moment. We are aware of the protests going on outside. I'm very aware of the concerns farmers feel. I've been engaging with the NFU.
That's the National Farmers Union. Feeling eyes boring into his back, he jabbed his thumb over his shoulder.
Some of the people in this room, we were having a chat before we came in as well, and some of them I've met before.
And he wanted them all to know things weren't as bad as they thought. According to the Treasury, fewer than 500 farms a year would feel the impact. And the economic watchdog, the OBR, and other top economists thought that was indeed the case.
I have every reason, and we should all have every reason, to believe that this data, projections based on actual hard data, is accurate and that the vast majority of farms will not be affected.
The Environment Committee chair, the Lib Dem Alistair Carmichael, didn't think that was how the folk with placards saw it.
So the farmers who are around the House of Commons today have also looked at their situation. They know their business, and there's a lot more than 500 here saying that they're going to be affected. Are they wrong?
Well, if the economists were right,
then many of them, probably happily, are wrong. Because there are things that they can do to plan their tax affairs, as most businesses or asset owners would do, to limit their liability.
But farmers shouldn't take his word for that.
The best thing to do isn't to listen to a minister of the crown as to what you should do with your tax affairs. It's to listen to your tax advisor, who can give you detailed advice based on your own personal circumstances to ensure that you are managing your tax affairs as effectively and efficiently as possible.
For another Lib Dem, Sarah Dyke, this was personal.
I'm from a farming family. I feel that very deeply about the devastation that farmers are going to have.
And she asked about the government's belief that farmland was being used for inheritance tax avoidance. Steve Reid told her the amount of farmland being bought by non-farmers, people who'd never farmed before, was increasing every year.
One of the best ways to shield a large amount of money from inheritance tax is to buy agricultural land. Now, that's not because they're interested in farming or in food security or food production.
But when Steve Reid claimed he was listening to farmers' concerns, a Conservative, Sarah Bull, rounded on him.
The best help would actually be to reconsider. You say you're listening, but it is really very much listening with closed ears at this point. One of my main concerns as well is that you have sort of set the threshold very low at 1 million. If you are actually wanting to tax those very, very, very wealthy farms, then why didn't you set it at an appropriate level? Because you must appreciate you are directly targeting the working farmers.
She said that owning three basic farm vehicles like a combine harvester and tractors would take a farm's assets over the £1 million threshold for paying inheritance tax. Steve Reid insisted that the government needed to raise money to mend public services.
You can't just magic money out of nowhere to fix these problems. Liz Truss tried that, and it crashed the economy and made it worse.
So
I'm just explaining why I listen. I'm just explaining why I'm listening to people in the countryside and why we're taking the action that we're taking. I know you don't like my answers, with the greatest respect.
Nobody gets heard if both are talking at the same time.
Alistair Carmichael trying to calm everyone down. And this time, a cup of coffee while listening to the Archers won't really help.
Susan Hume there. You can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and BBC Sounds.
It's now 7:09. People smuggling is illegal, but manufacturing, selling, moving inflatable boats is not. And that is just one of the many challenges facing those whose job it is to frustrate the small boat crossings across the Channel, including those here at Europe's busiest land crossing, the Bulgarian Police and Customs. At this crossing, more than 1 million lorries, almost 2 million cars. At times you may feel like you can hear them all in the background of our broadcast here today. It's because boats come across the border from Turkey and they are trying to find them. I've been speaking about that trade in boats to a woman called Tuesday Retano, Deputy Director of the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime.
Over the last couple of years, it's really consolidated that we've seen a single ethnicity group, the Kurds, take control. They've shifted into a far more professional and organised transit journey, which has meant that they've needed a volume of clients, of migrants, to keep it profitable. And that means they've been recruiting hard from the countries where they are based, which is a lot of, you know, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, that Kurdish territory, plus the countries behind it.
So Kurdish gangs organising much of this, and the boats themselves manufactured at scale in Turkey.
A lot of the traffic, when it was organised by more Moroccan and North African gangs, bought boats ad hoc along the French coast, bought it from local shops. But progressive waves of law enforcement to try and stop that, agreements, for example, with the company Decathlon to stop selling ribs, meant that the criminal groups had to manufacture themselves. The first wave was imported a lot from China, but now in subsequent years it's been Turkey.
The problem here is that boats in themselves are not illicit, are they? They're not like drugs or smuggled cigarettes or cash, for example. Inflatables are perfectly legal. They're legal in Turkey, they're legal in Bulgaria, they're legal when they reach Germany before they reach the Channel crossings. How difficult is it for the authorities to frustrate this trade?
It's enormously difficult to address the movement of boats for smuggling for two reasons. Firstly, as you've just pointed out, because the boats in and of themselves aren't illegal. So it requires the link to be made to the criminal groups, either through the purchase or through some indication of the intent. So the second issue is there, can we show that these boats are manufactured specifically for a crossing?
Now, we are at the Bulgarian-Turkey border, the external frontier of the EU, and we're here because the Bulgarians in many ways want to show off that they're doing their best to frustrate this trade. Realistically, with the huge number of vehicles going through a crossing like this, do you think it is possible to stop that trade?
In a meaningful way, no, it's not. I think all of the efforts at interdiction, which are an important signal to criminal groups that pressure is being put on them to stop what they're doing. But Turkey is one manufacturer, China still remains another, and criminal groups are inventive, they're creative. They use a lot of different ways to disguise what they're doing. And finally, I mean, ultimately, the infrastructure for detecting illicit trade is very weak. Capacity to screen containers, to check lorries, on average, the estimates are that less than 2% of total global trade ever gets screened in any meaningful way. And looking for rubber boats, it doesn't have the same level of identifiers as, say, arms. Engines are easier. Actually, of course, they're much more distinctive in terms of going through a scanner and being visible.
Tuesday Reitano, Deputy Director of the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime. Thank you very much indeed.
It's 5 minutes to seven. Let's think about the fact that this morning a group of health professionals coordinated by Healthcare Professionals for Safer Screens will present their report and findings on the health risks to children caused by smartphones at a private members' bill hearing for the Safer Phones Bill, which is put forward by Labour's Josh McAllister. Dr. Rebecca Foljam, GP and founder of that group, is here. Why did you want to set up this group? What have you found?
I wanted to set it up, Emma, because my concerns about children's addictive use of these screens and the whole body impacts those can have, something that we're going to try and get over to the MPs hearing our evidence today for Josh McAllister's bill. And I feel that what we found is that when I created this group earlier this year, it was very much pushing on an open door. I couldn't believe the response from a huge number of health professionals across many specialties from paediatrics, public health, psychiatry, dietary specialists. There's so many health professionals who are worried about this and came forward very quickly when I founded the group, which just showed me instantly the depth of concern across the whole range of health aspects for children,
What have you found?
So what we found is that these devices, the excessive use of these devices, are impacting on children in a really top to bottom way. They're impacting on their speech and language. We know that a quarter of our 3 to 4 year olds are owning their own smartphones now and accessing these devices. But for every minute of screen time at that age, they're hearing and speaking fewer words, which is profoundly impacting on their speech and language development. We've got nearly 2 million children waiting for speech and language help in this country. A quarter of the speech and language therapist posts are unfilled. We know the impacts on their eyesight. We've got 36% of our children now short-sighted. These are huge problems that are coming down the lines, impacting on their sleep, their musculoskeletal system. These devices and the addictive nature of the use of these devices, not just the children's access to harmful content, is the problem, which is why Josh McAllister's bill is so important to cover that ground now.
Well, Dr. Rebecca Foljam, we will be speaking to Peter Kyle a bit later on in the programme. It'll be interesting to put this to him with his brief on technology. Thank you for that. And if you have anything to contribute, whether you've noticed a change in your child after they've been on screens that perhaps aligns with some of these findings, do get in touch on 0330 123 4346 and message on WhatsApp or leave a voice message, or you can email us. Oh, perhaps you've noticed a change within yourself that fits there. And what are you doing about it? Dr. Rebecca Foljam, thank you.
Just before the weather, let's hear about Friday evenings, which are getting musical.
On BBC Radio 4.
I'm Anna Phoebe.
And I'm Jeffrey Bwachi.
It's really simple, which is why the groove is so strong.
I feel the earth move under.
We're discovering new and unexpected musical connections
to create a playlist like no other.
The musicians in this track are great, but when you hear her, you realise how much she's driving everything.
To start the series, we'll be joined by the saxophonist Jess Gillam and the songwriter Richard Stilgo. Hey,
this is about dreams. This is about what you can do when the music takes you somewhere.
The new series of Add to Playlist on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Starts on Friday evening at 7:15.
Oh, I love it. And it's going to warm us up because at 2 minutes to seven, here's the weather with Simon King.
Yeah, going to need it, Emma, because it is a cold start this morning. Temperatures widely below freezing. And we've had some fresh snow falling across Scotland and North Wales into the Midlands. So you may get some disruption this morning. And of course, watch out for some ice on untreated roads and pavements. Let's talk about England and Wales, where the snow showers across North Wales and the Midlands will gradually become more confined to North Wales into this afternoon. Around eastern England, we could see some wintry showers moving in, some snow over the higher ground here, for example, the North York Moors. But otherwise, lots of blue skies and lots of sunshine expected today, but it will feel cold with a brisk northwesterly wind. Scotland, Northern Ireland, snow showers continuing to move in across northern, western and eastern areas of Scotland. Lots of that over higher ground, but down to low levels as well. Plenty of sunshine elsewhere across Scotland. A bit more cloud, I think, for Northern Ireland today. Maximum temperatures freezing to 3 or 4 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. If you're just joining us, it is 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 20th of November. The headlines on this chilly day. President Biden has approved sending anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine to combat advances by Russian troops in another major reversal of defence policy. A new report says children as young as 11 are carrying knives in England to protect themselves. And the government says it will make the online safety bill tougher if tech companies do not do enough to protect people using their platforms.
Good morning from Europe's busiest border crossing. I'm at Capitan Andrevio, the gateway to Europe. And we'll be asking, what does it tell us about what's happening here, about what can be done to stop the boats made in Turkey before they reach the channel, and what can be done to frustrate the people smugglers too? And can Obama match Attenborough, the former president, turns his hand to Netflix narration.
The surface of the ocean is a portal to another world, one of mystery and drama.
I don't think Sir David's got too much to be worried about, but then perhaps I'm biased. That's all after the BBC News, read this morning by Jane Steele.
President Biden has approved the supply of anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine in another marked shift in policy in the final weeks of his time in office. Officials said Kiev had agreed not to use them in built-up areas. Washington had only just authorised the use of its long-range missiles to strike deep into Russia, which Ukraine has already deployed. Our North America correspondent John Sutworth reports from Washington.
A US official confirmed to the BBC that Ukraine would be supplied with what it's long been asking for, anti-personnel mines to impede the advance of Russian troops. It's a significant change in policy. 2 years ago, the Biden administration committed to limit the export of such weapons because of concerns about the long-lasting risk to civilian populations. The US official said the mines supplied would be non-persistent, meaning they're designed to degrade over much shorter timescales. The decision follows another big change, the permission to fire US-made missiles into Russia, which Ukraine acted upon almost immediately, striking an ammunition store some 70 miles outside its borders. The Biden administration is acting now out of two concerns: recent Russian advances and the prospect of a new Trump administration with a weaker commitment to military aid just 2 months away.
The man appointed as the UK's first border security commander has defended his role and expressed optimism that real progress can be made in stopping people smugglers. In his first broadcast interview since taking up the job in September, Martin Hewitt told this programme there was no simple answer to the problem, but the first step was to attack the smugglers' business model. Here's our home and legal correspondent Dominic Casciani.
The former police chief said the UK had to project its border beyond the English coast and northern France and take the fight to the organised crime gangs moving people and boats across Europe. He promised to chip away at the criminal business model until it was no longer profitable, a tactic used widely against organised crime. The former Conservative Home Secretary James Cleverly has accused Labour of making up a job that already existed, but Mr Hewitt said that the meetings he was now chairing, involving every relevant branch of government and law enforcement, were the first time they'd all been working collectively together. The government will soon unveil new powers to tackle smugglers, inspired by the fight against terrorism. It hopes that the new offences will, long term, make it harder and harder for gangs to operate.
You can hear the full interview with Martin Hewitt after 8:30. Within the past few minutes, new figures have shown that the rate of inflation went up last month. The Office for National Statistics said it rose to 2.3% from 1.7% in September. A new report says children in England as young as 11 are carrying knives because they feel unsafe. The joint study was carried out by Ofsted, the Care Quality Commission and the Police Fire and Probation Inspection Bodies. They also found that children with special educational needs and disabilities were disproportionately at risk of harm. Thomas McGill reports.
Inspectors looked at the experiences of hundreds of children and how local services responded to incidents of serious violence involving young people. They concluded that such violence was now widespread and that whole communities were affected. It also found the problem was far more far-reaching than many adults realised. The report said parents were very concerned for the safety of their children and that in some cases children said they carried knives in order to protect themselves. According to the report, inspectors in some areas were alarmed that children as young as 11 were regularly carrying knives. Despite some good practice being found, inspectors also identified examples where partnerships were consistently failing to identify serious violence.
The government has made clear it is prepared to make the online safety bill tougher if tech companies don't do enough to protect users of their platforms. The legislation comes into force fully next spring. The Technology Secretary, Peter Carr, says he wants the regulator Ofcom to be more assertive with firms and report back on what action has been taken. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Peter Kyle lists five key areas for Ofcom to prioritise. This includes collecting evidence that tech firms are embedding safety features such as age verification tools into their platforms designed to protect children and minimise the spread of illegal content and disinformation. But Ofcom itself will not safety test products before they're released. Mr Kyle also calls for the regulator to be prepared to tackle emerging harms such as the rise of AI-generated material and said he would consider strengthening the Online Safety Act in the future if he found it was needed. Some critics have argued that the current legislation does not go far enough.
More than 1,900 people in the UK are taking legal action against the manufacturer of Johnson's baby powder, claiming repeated use caused their cancers. Lawyers bringing the legal claims say Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder contained traces of asbestos, which is known to cause cancer. It's the first time litigation has been brought against the company outside of the United States, where it has been sued repeatedly. Johnson & Johnson denies any link between its product and cancer. Charlie Haynes reports.
The women believe Johnson's talcum powder, which they say contained asbestos, played a part in their cancer. Their lawyers allege Johnson & Johnson knew about the possible contamination decades ago but didn't act on it. The firm has paid out or set aside at least $13 billion in response to cases in the US, but this is a legal first in the UK. It began using cornstarch rather than mineral talc last year, citing commercial pressures due to what it called misinformation. The firm denies the allegations, which it says ignore the facts, and insists it takes product safety incredibly seriously.
The NHS has set up a blood testing programme to detect potentially dangerous viruses that could spread to the UK because of climate change. Thousands of samples will be screened over the coming months for diseases including West Nile virus, which are normally found in hotter areas of the world. Here's our health reporter, Philippa Roxby.
With global warming and increased international travel and trade, mosquitoes are pushing further north into Europe. The species capable of spreading West Nile virus has recently been found in southern England, raising the potential risk of an infection there. There have been no human cases in the UK yet, nor of another virus called Usutu found in birds. But officials at the UK Health Security Agency have identified these two viruses, plus another in ticks, as potential emerging infections in the coming decades.
The career of one of the all-time greats of tennis, Rafael Nadal, has come to an end. The 22-time Grand Slam winner was part of the Spanish team eliminated from the Davis Cup by the Netherlands in Malaga. Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller reports.
The perfect finale of a Spanish victory in Sunday's Davis Cup final was ended by the Netherlands, with Rafael Nadal's animated support from the team bench unable to sway the result of the decisive doubles match. Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, Andy Murray and Serena Williams then paid their tributes in a video presentation which moved Nadal and his family to tears. The Spaniard extended his career to an age few had thought possible given the severity of knee and foot injuries and will be remembered for the physicality of his performances, winning 14 French Open titles and his enduring relationship with Federer. They contested one of the greatest sporting duels of all time in the Wimbledon final of 2008. He made Spain proud and the whole tennis world proud, was how Federer summed it up in a valedictory social media post.
Russell Fuller reporting.
Good morning from the biggest land crossing in Europe, Capitan Andrevo. Each year, over 1 million lorries and 2 million cars cross from Turkey into Bulgaria and the EU beyond. Along with supplies and stocks for shops, factories and warehouses on either side of this border, alongside those making the journeys, not just from Turkey, but Iran and Iraq and Syria, Georgia and Azerbaijan, come migrants who want a new life in Europe, and the boats that will carry some across the channel to Britain. 90% of the crude, purpose-built, flimsy inflatables used by people smugglers have been traced to Turkey, which is why what happens at this border matters. That's why the British government cares what's happening here. It's why they train the border officers here. And indeed, a sniffer dog called Adele, who we'll meet later in the programme, who's been trained to sniff out rubber. Another reason the government cares is that migrants, as well as boats, try to cross this border from Turkey. Despite the fearsome-looking fences, the cameras, the drones, which we reported on Monday. What's happening here is, in many ways, a test case for Keir Starmer's belief that greater international cooperation, better policing and intelligence can, in his phrase, smash the gangs. I've been talking about that to Atanas Rousseff, Director of Security at the Centre for the Study of Democracy in Sofia, an expert in border security. I asked him how security looks, not just at this crossing point, but the long border between his country, Bulgaria, and Turkey.
You have these patrols that are moving across certain sections of the border. Then you have the fence, but the fence actually is not a big obstacle because you need a simple wooden ladder to just climb and cross it. Then we have, of course, all these sensors, drones, and so on. But if you don't react in a matter of an hour or something, these people just move into the territory, and many of their guides, they know the terrain very well. They try to move these people from this border zone as quickly as possible, and the logistics are, they have perfected them.
Given that it is a growing business, does it mean there is always money potentially for corruption, for payments to officials, to border guards, to the police, to maybe look the other way?
Corruption has always been an issue, but I would say if you think that you can stop these irregular flows just for policing and prosecution and securitizing, it's a road to nowhere.
Can you describe for our listeners the trade in boats across the border from Turkey to Bulgaria? Where are they coming from? Where are they going? And what sort of scale is this trade?
What we know from field research is that more than 90% of the boats that they have detected or seized are manufactured in Turkey.
And they had to then come into Europe across the border with Bulgaria.
Sure, but boats are illegal commodity. It's not illicit like drugs or something. Turkey is part of the customs union with a lot of other European countries. So when you have a legal commodity moving through Bulgaria, Bulgarian customs authorities are even not supposed to meticulously check these goods. If there is any indications that these goods might be somehow unsafe or dangerous for European consumers, then they can check and seize these goods according to the European consumer safety legislation. So you cannot distinguish between these goods because, you know, it could have a legitimate use, let's say in Germany or Poland, for fishing or for, I don't know, leisure activities or something. So
what can the Bulgarian authorities do? And what are the British government paying for those authorities to do more of?
What British and Bulgarian authorities agreed is to start more closely monitoring these goods. And in order to do so, Bulgarian authorities used a specific power that they had. A Bulgarian customs authority can assign a certain entry point for certain goods. So they stated that such boats should enter Bulgaria through a single entry point, and this was the Rail Customs Bureau at the Bulgarian-Turkish border.
That's Kapitan Andrevo, this huge border crossing between Bulgaria and Turkey.
Keep in mind that the land crossing is, like, really busy. It's the busiest land entry point in the European Union. But actually, the rail entry point is not that busy. We don't have that many trains going back and forth between Bulgaria and Turkey. So this allowed the Bulgarian Customs Authority to really scrutinize all these goods. But as soon as they introduced these restrictions, the importers, the companies that were actually transporting these goods, they stopped declaring that they're actually transporting such goods.
The criminals knew that if they said that they were importing boats, they might get stopped. So what did they say they were importing instead? Did they pretend it was something else?
Yeah, usually they'll try to say that it's something else made of rubber, like rubber castles for kids or something like this. They also tried other ways to circumvent this. For example, they would first enter Greece and then enter through some other of the Bulgarian cross points with Greece. And in this way, they were trying somehow to, you know, circumvent customs control. They're adapting so quickly that once you introduce certain restriction or regulation, they find another way to go around.
So when you hear a politician say, we will deal with this problem of mass migration by smashing the gangs, what do you think?
You cannot stop this thing just with introducing restrictions or with more policing. You have to have a more comprehensive, complex approach. With addressing the smugglers, you're addressing the push factors. But then you also have to think about the pull factors. What brings these people to your country?
Atanas Rusev, Director of the Security Programme at the Centre for the Study of Democracy in Sofia. Thank you very much for joining me. In just under an hour's time, we'll hear what is happening here at the border. And straight after the programme at 9 o'clock, Amal's going to be joining me for a special live recording of the Today podcast on BBC Sounds to talk more about what we've seen and heard in the last few days. If you want to get in touch, if you want to pose a question to us, please use WhatsApp number +44 330 123 4346. That's +44 330 123 4346. Or you can email today@bbc.co.uk. Just go to BBC Sounds and you can go to the live feed for that broadcast.
At 16 minutes past seven, let's think about space, shall we? Space and politics. President-elect Donald Trump was in Texas last night with his advisor on government efficiencies, or as he will be, a.k.a. the world's richest man, Elon Musk, for the launch of Musk's SpaceX sixth test flight of the Starship spacecraft. Let's take a listen to that moment of liftoff.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Listening to that with us, who can help? She always does. Professor Catherine Haymans, Astronomer Royal for Scotland. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma. It was an absolutely beautiful launch, as always. I'm not sure if people have seen Starship. It does look a little bit like the Thunderbirds. It has two stages. There's the super heavy booster on the bottom of it, and then Starship sits on the top. It's a very large rocket ship, and ultimately the hope is that it can carry up to 100 people. Its height is 122 metres when you combine Starship and Super Heavy together. So imagine Big Ben and a little bit taller on the top. And what we were super excited about watching was the Super Heavy booster being caught by chopsticks. So a month ago in the fifth test flight, there was this amazing operation where it came back down and was caught in the launch pad. But unfortunately, that didn't happen yesterday.
Yes, I was going to say, what didn't happen that was meant to happen? In layman's terms, I like the fact the chopsticks are involved, though.
So the vision of Elon Musk and SpaceX is that this biggest and most powerful rocket that's ever been built is going to be completely and fully reusable. So they need to catch all of the parts again. But last night they didn't catch the first stage booster. There was automated health checks on the launch and catch tower. So there was nothing wrong with the rocket itself. It was the catching mechanism that failed. So in an abundance of caution, they landed it in the sea. So if you want to check on Google this morning, you can see it hovering down over the ocean and then it tumbles over and there's a big fireball explosion, which is fun to watch.
Okay. That's just however you get your thrills, I suppose. But, you know, I did mention there about the president-elect being there. It's quite a sight watching Donald Trump standing there with a lot of people, their red caps, their MAGA caps on, Make America Great Again. But I wonder for you, what does that mean, do you think, this intersection of politics and the space race, the billionaire space race at the moment? Does it mean that there is greater optimism, perhaps, about America's role and the future of that?
Yeah, so I feel very conflicted about this. So if you look at what SpaceX has achieved, it is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, this company is really pushing and advancing technology. And Elon Musk is the founder, but we should really recognise Gwynn Shotwell here. She's the chief operating officer and really is the person in charge and creating all this innovation. But with Elon Musk gaining this influence in American politics, there is cause for concern because he talks often about the burdensome regulations. So the US Federal Aviation Administration has to approve all of the launches. And Elon Musk is famous for saying, if things aren't failing, you aren't innovating enough. But when it comes to human flight, you know, the plan for Starship is that it will ultimately carry 100 people. Safety is really important. So there has to be this balance between safety and innovation. And this, with Musk getting more involved with politics and that overlap between technology and politics, there's that concern that this deregulation that he's pushing is going to cause some problems. So I do feel very conflicted. On the one hand side, I'm absolutely cheering for the amazing success and what it will allow us to do. So Starship is really important for NASA's plans to get humans back to the moon in the Artemis program over the next few years.
Yes.
And Musk also has plans for exploration of Mars, which as a scientist I get really excited about. But the flip side of that is that this has to be done carefully, it has to be done safely and responsibly.
We'll talk again. Professor Catherine Hamers, Astronomer Royal for Scotland. Thank you.
20 past seven now. An important piece of economic data has just been published. It's the rate of inflation, the rate, in other words, at which prices are increasing, and it is back up, Will Bain.
That's right, Nick, and important, not just because of that headline rate that you mentioned, but some of the other numbers within it as well. Key things that the Bank of England looks at when it does things like setting interest rate policy. The Office for National Statistics say in the last few minutes that inflation came in at 2.3%. That was compared with 1.7% in September, driven largely, they say, by the increase in Ofgem's energy price cap. But there was also a little uptick, a slight growth in services inflation. So where does the cost pressure come from services? Let's speak to Steve Hare, Chief Executive of the Sage Group, FTSE 100 tech company that employs more than 3,000 people across the UK and Ireland. They've also just released their full year financial results in the past few minutes as well. Steve, morning.
Good morning, Will.
So that services inflation number up 5% here, so up a smidge on the month before, but it's stayed pretty stubbornly high. What is it for service businesses like yourselves that's still costing so much?
Yeah, and I think that we've delivered a strong set of results today. So, you know, we've been focusing on our own productivity, as well as delivering innovation for small businesses and trying to help them deal with productivity. But I think obviously you've got, you know, continuing pressure in terms of both people costs, wage costs, and also some of those raw material costs. And they're just headwinds that small businesses have to contend with.
Right. Those people costs still there, even before some of the changes that haven't yet filtered through from the budget.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we're trying to do is focus on helping our customers to become more efficient, helping them to automate, you know, their finance, HR, payroll, back office processes. And I think when I speak to small businesses, which I do all the time, you know, they're all very focused on how can they make themselves more effective, how can they, you know, deal with some of these cost headwinds, which remain do remain an issue.
Your results look really strong, very big jump in profits, big drivers in revenue, particularly in your US operations. And we just heard Professor Hayman's talking with Emma there about the potential for the Trump administration and Elon Musk to roll back a lot of regulations. AI, another area that they're talking about cutting back regulations. You, of course, have got an AI product, Sage Copilot. Is that good news for you?
Yeah, I mean, we're we're using AI in a fairly narrow way. So, you know, we're developing a large language model in conjunction with AWS, which is focused very much on accounting and compliance. So a very focused area. So we're not at that sort of leading edge, which the regulators are interested in. We're very much interested in real-world solutions for our small business customers.
Steve, thanks so much for your time. Steve Hare there, the Chief Executive of the Sage Group.
Will, thank you. It's 23 minutes past seven. The decision to remove winter fuel payments from millions of pensioners prompted the first unrest for the new Labour government when it came in. The ministers involved insisted it would still support the poorest pensioners. Now, the government's own estimates suggest that an extra 50,000 pensioners will be living in relative poverty next year as a result of that decision. And those cuts, the government has highlighted that the estimates do not take into account its efforts to encourage more pensioners to apply for pension credit. That's an extra bit of support. Well, Rachel Maskell is Labour MP for York Central and was one of the critics of this change and abstained in the Commons on that vote. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
50,000 into poverty next year from that winter fuel cut. I did talk about that caveat. We'll come to that in just a moment. But what do you make of that? What are you seeing? And temperatures, of course, as I speak to you, are dropping.
Well, it's deeply worrying in the light that temperatures are now below freezing for many people across the country. And of course, for the elderly, this could have serious consequences and compromise their health. Indeed, we fear that some will be living in colder, damper homes, and that could have an impact on them requiring the NHS or worse. So, of course, there is deep concern, and that's why I couldn't support the cut to the winter fuel payments. That means £300 for people over 80 or £200 for pensioners under the age of 80. That's a lot of money which could help contribute towards your heating bills. The advice to all older people is that you need to maintain your home at around 18 degrees Celsius to keep safe, well and warm this winter. So we encourage people to do that and to seek help from the energy companies or indeed your local authority. But of course, really concerned that many people could go cold if they don't switch on the heating.
And presumably, I mean, looking at the letter clarifying the figures, Working Pensions Secretary Liz Kendall, you would support the promotion of taking up of this pension credit, which will help and could help a lot of people.
Absolutely, 100%. I really do urge people that haven't yet sought out whether or not they're eligible for pension credit to do so. They need to do that before the 21st of December, which is when government will cut off the opportunity to apply for winter fuel payments this winter. However, and I have asked for that date to be extended because obviously January and February is also cold. But what I would say is only around 84,000 people, according to a parliamentary question I asked, between the announcement in July and the end of September actually made that claim, when we know that there were around 880,000 people who could be eligible for the pension credit. But there are people above that threshold who also experience fuel poverty, and we need to protect them too.
Let's just come to that. I mean, it did go ahead. This is the reality. It was one of the first decisions Labour made. Of course, we've had the budget since then. The reason given, and I wanted to see if you have thought about this rationale anymore and can come towards thinking of it and understanding it, is that when Rachel Reeves saw the books, she says this cut saves £1.5 billion a year. The government has to prioritise putting finances on a stable footing. What do you make of that?
I completely understand why she made that decision in July. However, carrying out an impact assessment would have demonstrated back in the summer the implications of this policy. And we have got to protect the poor also. Of course, it is always about...
Do you feel the Labour government...
balanced on the back of pensioners.
Do you think the Labour government have abandoned those people?
Well, we're already seeing Labour in Scotland recognise the need for reparation, and so are the leader of Scottish Labour Party has said that he would want to increase the eligibility for pension credits. So that's one of the options moving forward. I've presented the option of having warm home prescriptions. So if doctors recognise that their patients could be compromised because of the cold, they could make a contribution towards keeping those people safe, well and warm over the winter. There are options available, but we must ensure that older people don't go cold, because they'll simply end up in our NHS putting more pressure on that service, which we know.
I suppose I was trying to get a sense if you were being heard in Westminster. I'll put it to Peter Carr, who we'll be talking to shortly. Rachel Maskell, Labour MP for York Central, thank you.
28 minutes past seven. Here's Mike with the sport. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Nick. Some welcome news today for Manchester City fans. Manager Pep Guardiola has signed a contract extension. The Spaniard has won 18 trophies in 8 years at City, including 6 Premier League titles. His contract was up at the end of this season, but is now believed to have been extended by a further 12 months, although City, as yet, are refusing to comment. Meanwhile, let's get more on that promotion party in Cardiff. Wales are back in the top tier of European football's Nations League after coming from behind to beat Iceland 4-1 last night, thanks in part to...
Harry Wilson makes it 4! Wales are going to win this Nations League group! It's an incredible start to Craig Bellamy's tenure as the Wales head coach!
Certainly is. Craig Bellamy remains unbeaten as Wales manager. 3 victories and 3 draws from his 6 matches in charge.
Probably feel it was important to show people that, like, I'm not a lunatic. I'm quite sane. People think I was going to be, like, running on the pitch and pushing a ref and stuff. And no. Like, you obviously don't know me, but I felt probably more pushed into management to show that.
Well, we can speak to the former Wales striker, Sam Vokes, who joins us now live on the programme. Morning, Sam.
Morning, Mike. You okay?
Yeah, really good, thank you. Cracking win for Wales, wasn't it? And it marks a real upturn in fortunes for a team that had been on a downward trajectory over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it was a great win last night and a fantastic performance to round off a great Nations League campaign for us. And we also had the miracle result out in Montenegro, which helped us, with Montenegro beating Turkey 3-1, which meant obviously we topped the group. And I've got promoted to League A, Group A of Nations League. So that's a great bonus, and also the bonus of possibly a playoff for the World Cup in 26, which is something to look forward to.
And this remarkable turnaround has come under the new manager, Craig Bellamy. You presumably played alongside him at the start of your international career. What is he like as a player, as a man? And did you have any inkling that he might go on to manage the national team?
Yeah, it's great to see him, really. I played alongside him. He was a great player for Wales, someone that I always looked up to as a player, and someone that I probably knew was going to go into management because he was always a leader and someone we looked up to. But I think for Wales at the minute, he's proven to be the leader we all knew, and taking us to new heights.
Yeah, quite amusing there, wasn't it, hearing him say that he had to prove to people that he's not a lunatic. He did have a bit of a reputation of being a bit wild in his playing days, but any doubters, as you say, that he did have as Wales manager, he's proving them wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the calmness that he has on the touchline at the minute is kind of proof to... Leader off the field that we didn't quite see on the field all the time, but no, it's great. And I think he is, the style of play that he's got is something that Wales fans cried out for a long time.
Yeah, and again, it's proof as well that the Wales do have a new generation. There were fears, weren't there, when we lost the likes of Gareth Bale, Aaron Ramsey, Joe Allen, that those players that had got Wales to the Euros in 2016, to the World Cup in 22, that golden generation had now gone. But it looks like that the future can still be bright.
Oh, of course, it's amazing. I think the way Craig Bellamy lines his team up and the way we're playing is exciting. Kind of gets bums off seats in the crowd, and that's what everyone expected when Craig Bellamy came into the fold, because that's what he was like as a player. I think it's proved to be, and I think this generation now are taking on a whole new kind of aura around them, and they've got that kind of expectation on themselves now to get to a tournament, as they've seen previous generations do that in the last 10 years or so. So very much looking forward to what the future holds under Bellamy.
Well, Sam Vokes, we appreciate you taking time out from childcare this morning. We'll let you get back to daddy duties, but many thanks for joining us on the programme. That is Sam Vokes reflecting on Wales' victory last night, which, as Sam also alluded to, also allows Wales a playoff for the World Cup in 2026.
Screams of joy there. I'm sure. Enhanced that interview enormously. 28 minutes to 8. Let's hear from Michael Berg ahead of this evening's Moral Maze. Maybe some screams there, Michael.
Hardly. President-elect Trump's eclectic, some would say wacko, top team appear to have just one thing in common. Loyalty to Mr. Trump himself seems to be the main qualification to run the United States, a country, of course, founded on one of history's most conspicuous acts of disloyalty. It's the most Roman of virtues and perhaps the most ambiguous. Only last week, Anglican officials were being pilloried for putting loyalty to the church and its reputation above safeguarding children. The essential glue for human relationships is also blamed for all manner of conflict and cover-up. So, is loyalty a vice or a virtue? Who or what is deserving of it? The Moral Maze, after the news at 8 tonight.
Thank you, Michael. No screaming. No guarantee of that, of course. Turn to the weather now. Well, here at the edge of Europe, it's actually rather warm and sunny, but I'm seeing lots of videos from friends and colleagues of blustery, snowy showers. They're going to happen today in the far north of Scotland, dry and bright for many elsewhere.
You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London and Nick Robinson in Bulgaria. I hope we keep you warm this morning. At 26 minutes to 8 on this chilly day, let's get a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
New figures show that the rate of inflation went up last month, in part due to rising energy prices. The Office for National Statistics said inflation rose to 2.3% from 1.7% in September. Annual gas and electricity bills increased by about £149 last month. The Treasury Chief Secretary, Darren Jones, acknowledged there was more to do to ease cost of living pressures. President Biden has approved the supply of anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine in another marked shift in policy in the final weeks of his time in office. The move follows the authorization for Ukraine to use American-made long-range missiles to hit targets inside Russia. Kiev has pledged to avoid deploying the landmines in densely populated areas. Ukraine will also be prohibited from using them outside of its territory. The US Special Envoy Amos Hochstein has expressed hope that an end to the war between Israel and Hezbollah is now within grasp. He's held talks in Beirut about a ceasefire plan, which has been largely endorsed by Lebanon and Hezbollah. But the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said military operations against Hezbollah would continue even if a ceasefire was reached. A new report says children in England as young as 11 are carrying knives because they feel unsafe. The study was carried out by Ofsted, the Care Quality Commission and the Police, Fire and Probation Inspection Bodies. They also found that children with special educational needs and disabilities were disproportionately at risk of youth violence. The government has made clear it is prepared to make the online safety bill tougher if tech companies don't do enough to protect users of their platforms. The legislation comes into force fully next spring. The Technology Secretary, Peter Kyle, says he wants the regulator Ofcom to be more assertive with firms and report back on what action has been taken. Commuters are facing widespread disruption this morning because of heavy snowfall and ice in parts of the UK. A warning for ice remains in place for much of southern England, the Midlands and eastern Wales. The Met Office is advising vehicles could become stranded, power cuts may occur and rural areas could be cut off.
Thank you, Jane. 24 minutes to 8. If you're angered by the sight of migrants trying to make their way to Britain across the Channel, or moved by the sight, or perhaps both. One thing is clear. Britain cannot solve the problem of small boats on its own. International cooperation is crucial in a battle against the people smuggling business, estimated now to be worth €6 billion a year worldwide. Now, you may be able to hear behind me cars and lorries being stopped here at Europe's biggest land checkpoint, Capitan Andreevo. The EU and the British government are working with the Bulgarian authorities to try and reinforce this frontier to make it harder for the small boats, all of almost all of which are made in Turkey, to reach the Channel, and indeed for migrants to try to cross the border into Europe without the necessary paperwork. The harder they try, the more there are reports of human rights abuses, corrupt officials demanding huge sums to help desperate people, or pushing refugees back over the border without their asylum claims even being considered. I've been talking to Maria Chereshova, radio host and investigative journalist who's worked extensively on migration routes here in Bulgaria. She told me why her country wants to be seen to crack down on the people coming in.
Bulgaria has been under pressure by the EU and certain European countries, for example, such as Austria, to significantly cut migration in order to be accepted in the Schengen free space. And since this pressure has been very, very vocal, there have been many, many cases of questionable practices by the Bulgarian authorities, such as pushbacks, such as increase of violence in order not to allow people to enter European territory.
The policing that we are being shown looks impressive. It looks rather frightening if you wanted to cross that border. But we hear from migrants that the people smugglers know how to avoid it. They know how to get round it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes they work together with the Bulgarian institutions. You can bribe people.
Police, border officials, government officials.
There have been several cases when border officials have been revealed as participants in such type of smuggling schemes. I'm not saying that the authorities are not doing what they can, but it's a very complex channels that have been functioning for decades, actually.
Well, listening to that is our old friend, a familiar voice here on Radio 4, Misha Glennie, an expert on the Balkans, currently rector of the Institute for Human Services in Vienna. Morning to you, Misha. It's interesting looking at why Bulgaria wants to be seen to be doing so much to reinforce this frontier, so much to do with the politics of the wider Europe.
That's right, Nick. Earlier this year, Austria, the Austrian Chancellor, blocked the attempt of Romania and Bulgaria to become part of the Schengen free movement zone. And the reason why he was doing that was not actually to do with the flow of migration. It was to do with domestic Austrian politics, because he faced a challenge in the general election from the far-right Freedom Party, who were making migration the big issue. And so he infuriated not just the Romanians and the Bulgarians, but actually many other European countries for blocking Romania and Bulgaria. So the Bulgarians felt extremely disappointed, having made the efforts that you and Maria were talking about, to try and tighten up Capitan and Andreeva. And it's very interesting that you're there, because Capitan Andreeva has for many, actually not just decades, but centuries, been critical in all sorts of smuggling operations from the Middle East and Central Asia into Europe.
It's being highlighted by the Bulgarian authorities to us, in some ways by the British authorities as well, because they want to show that you can crack down on the smuggling gangs. But the history of smuggling here suggests it's not necessarily a winning battle, is it, Misha?
That's right. And unfortunately, in the past 3 or 4 years, Bulgaria has fallen into a period of political chaos, not for the first time in its history. It's had, I think, 5 or 6 elections in the past 3 years, almost impossible to form a government. And the point that was being made about corruption is also very serious in Bulgaria. It's had a struggle with organized crime ever since the collapse of communism in 1989. And simply speaking, the Bulgarian state just doesn't have enough resources or political stability in order to deal with this comprehensively.
I should say that the head of border security, I mean, his office, I've got to say it really, haven't I? So they do a lot to deal with corruption by changing the shift patterns, making sure that people are on different desks on different days, so they're harder to corrupt. There's a wider issue, though, isn't there? The influence of Bulgaria's, and I use this phrase in inverted commas, old friend Russia here. There is an influence on this region as a whole when we come to the politics of migration.
Well, the Balkans as a whole is still a contested area between EU influence and Russian influence. At the moment, Bulgaria's president, Rumen Radev, is well known as being sympathetic to the Kremlin. He's just in the last 24 hours, he's criticized the use of Ukraine's use allowed by the US of long-range missiles onto Russian territory. And there are suspicions that the Russians are using the migration issue in order to destabilize the European Union. But actually, I don't think that Bulgaria is the biggest problem here, because they are so keen and concerned to get into Schengen that they really are making a pretty big effort, given those sparse resources, to try and do something about the pressure from the EU and countries like the UK.
But this route, and as you will know, Misha, these routes are given broad geographical descriptions. The so-called Eastern Mediterranean route, which includes across the sea from Turkey to Greece, as well as across this border from Turkey to Bulgaria. It, at the moment, appears to be one of those growing in terms of illegal migration.
Yes, and that's right. And the other thing that's been happening in the past couple of weeks is that Turkey is beginning to express its unhappiness with the arrangements of the EU, whereby the EU pays Turkey money in order to keep the refugees inside Turkey. They have about 4 million there, and President Erdogan has been expressing his unhappiness with this and saying that it's time for them to go home or to go wherever it is they're seeking to go to. So there's going to be renewed pressure
on this border. Misha Glenny, thank you for joining us. You heard him talk there about the history of this border. Look on BBC Sounds for The Invention of Turkey. He's done a whole series of series, but that's the relevant one for this. BBC Sounds for Misha Glenny's brilliant analysis of that.
That sounds fascinating. At 16 minutes to 8, we were talking about President-elect and the space race again, or the modern space race earlier. What about former presidents? What are they up to? Because one in particular, he could retire, but instead he's narrating the story of a clownfish and other sea life. The recognisable voice of the former US President Barack Obama is back in nature lovers' ears as he narrates, and alongside his wife Michelle Obama, executively produces a new 5-part docu-nature series on Netflix called Our Oceans. Let's hear a bit of Barack Obama taking on Sir David Attenborough.
The surface of the ocean is a portal to another world. One of mystery and drama.
James Honeyborn, executive producer of Our Oceans, who worked alongside Barack and Michelle Obama, is here. Tell us the focus of this, first of all. What are you looking at in Our Oceans?
Well, what we want to do is tell the new stories, the really exciting, incredible stories of new sea creatures, the extraordinary new behaviours and the wonderful spectacles in a world that's more like our own than we might ever imagined. If you enjoyed Blue Planet 2, I hope you're going to love this, because it's, each ocean has its own story to tell, but there's also a building narrative that flows between the episodes. It feels like we could just... every episode links into the next, and it took an amazing team of over 700 people over 5 years to make.
Gosh, 700 people, yeah. Yes. I was looking through some of the stories, and the puffins in the North Atlantic. We were looking not just under, but looking around. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the puffin has a poignant story because, you know, they're wonderful creatures, but they struggle to find food these days. And that's partly because of fishing practices in the North Atlantic. It's also because of the increased number of storms. And that means some of the females are actually struggling to get fit enough to create eggs. And so the males come back and they're awaiting their females. They're digging the burrows, getting them all spruced up, ready to go. And their mates, because they mate for life, just don't turn up. And so it's a real challenge. But it's one of the things about all the changing seas that we witnessed across the series. We don't frame out humanity in this one.
And also, you did track an octopus for days and being slapped down by a rock, I believe, is it?
No, so the octopus...
Tell us about this wrong, or what the story is.
The octopus story is extraordinary. We wanted to film this little octopus, and they're very charismatic little animals and obviously very intelligent, but they don't live very long, so they're curious. This one was living amongst a litter-strewn seabed, so plastic debris was everywhere, and it was exploring it and trying to work out where it might best hunt. And we saw a fish swim over to it one day because it had just been eating a crab and the fish seemed to want the crab shell. But as it came close, it suddenly looked startled, almost as if it had been slapped in the face by the octopus. But we couldn't understand exactly what had happened until we played the footage back in slow motion that night. And you can see a pebble being fired out of the octopus's siphon directly into the face of the fish. And you realise it's really a pea shooter. And science did not even know that this happened. It's totally new discovery. So there's a scientific paper being written on that. And that's just one of 20 scientific papers being written off the back of the series.
And Barack Obama's voice alongside it. Absolutely. Giving David Attenborough, Sir David, a run for his money, do we think?
They're both great men, but President Obama is just perfect for this because, you know, he's an authentic man of the ocean. He's born in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. He's protected more of the oceans than pretty much anyone else on the planet.
Well, that was very diplomatically sidestepped. You could have thrown a stone at me, octopus style, but you didn't. James Honeyborn, executive producer alongside the Obamas of Our Oceans on Netflix.
Words carefully chosen there. 12 minutes to 8 now. Time for thought for the day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, Vicar of St. Martin in the Fields. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. In 2020, a group of activists, legislators, campaigners and councillors organised pre-election primaries in Hong Kong. They were aiming to win a majority in the general election and thereby force the dissolution of the legislature and resignation of the chief executive. Yesterday, 45 of the group were jailed for conspiracy to commit subversion. They're facing up to 10 years in prison. They join a great tradition of those who've made the struggle for democracy their deepest calling. William Lovett faced prison for leading the Chartists in England in 1839. Christabel Pankhurst was sent many times to jail in her quest for women's suffrage before the First World War. At his Rivonia trial in 1964, Nelson Mandela called a democratic and free society an ideal for which I am prepared to die. We can imagine the debates and heart-searchings among the Hong Kong activists as they weighed up the likelihood of their success, the potential wider impact of their campaign, and the consequences of its likely failure. Over the mantelpiece at home, I have a vivid Italian painting called The Fourth Estate, depicting a woman holding a baby while pleading with her husband to desist from leading a workers' march during a strike. Such struggles can divide families and communities. One of the most fascinating moments in the Gospels comes when Jesus tells his disciples he's turning towards Jerusalem. The disciples protest, "You'll face hostility and likely death," but Jesus insists he's going anyway. It's hard to tell from the story if he comes across as a headstrong activist, unwilling to be restrained by reason, patience and strategy, or as a humble servant, faithful to his calling, regardless of the consequences. Given we're still talking about him and many are shaping their lives around him 2,000 years later, it's hard to say he'd made the wrong decision. But he takes the opportunity to articulate a remarkable vision. Those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? He's saying he understands the impulse to preserve one's existence, but some things are more important. Not everyone finds themselves facing the prospect of death or long-term imprisonment for their commitment to make the world better for others. But many people face a threshold when they're drawn to comfort and well-being for themselves, yet hear a voice inside or beyond that's saying, this is the moment for which your life has been a preparation. You've stumbled upon and been confronted by something you can't ignore, an idea for which you're prepared to die.
That was Thought for the Day with Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, Vicar of St. Martin in the Fields. It's 9 minutes to eight. Now, the new laws, you've been hearing about this in the news bulletins, designed to make us all safe when we go online and onto social media, will not come into force fully until next spring. And yet there are already questions about whether the legislation, it's taken a fair while to get, is robust enough. The Technology Secretary, Peter Kyle, is today telling the regulator Ofcom to be more assertive with the technology companies which provide our gateway to the online world and some of the horrifying and harmful content which lies there. Peter Carr, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. Good morning to you. I suppose I start there. Will you be prepared? Will you toughen up the Online Safety Act?
Good morning, Emma. I'll do what it takes to keep people, particularly children and people with vulnerabilities, safe online. What I'm trying to do, and you can see with the letter of strategic intent that I've issued today, is to try and just create a regulatory environment which is agile, it is reflexive, but it is also more assertive going forward, because there are more powers which are being released to Ofcom. I just want to make sure that Ofcom knows that government expects them to be used, expects them to be used in a way that keeps moving forward. So, for example, age verification is one that's coming in into force from January, and additional powers coming in the spring, as you said, and into the summer. I want to make sure that tech companies know that if they don't take very seriously the need to keep young people protected from certain activity online and certain websites online, that there will be assertive response to it. But also,
is there a mandatory requirement for technology firms to enforce the minimum age?
There will be next year from January, and then the first set comes in January. Another set of rules go live in the summer. Look, I inherited a sort of unsavoury landscape when it came to the legislation. Yes. when we came in, but I now have to make sure that these rules get into statute, that they add up to an environment where, and this is the overall philosophy I'm trying to move towards, where safety is baked in from the outset. So in other words, algorithms are there to protect people, not to exploit vulnerabilities. So
I suppose I'm just going back to your words in the summer. You said, and you know, we're 4 months on now, the Online Safety Act was clearly a bit leaky at the moment. What have you done in those months since?
What I've done is use the powers I have creatively to tackle some of those areas that I think there are gaps in the law. So, for example, for intimate image abuse, I used a power a few weeks ago, which means that to insist that social media companies use the algorithms to prevent intimate images from going online in the first place. They had to proactively demonstrate to our regulator, Ofcom, that the algorithms would prevent that material going on in the first place. And if an image did appear online, they needed to be taken down as fast as reasonably could be expected after being alerted. Now, there were heavy fines for violating that, and it's one area where you can see that harm is being prevented rather than actually getting out into society and then us dealing with it afterwards, which is what's happening before. Now, thousands and thousands of women are now prevented from having the degradation, the humiliation, and sometimes being pushed towards suicidal thoughts because of that one power that I enacted.
Well, there are those who still worry about this app. They worry about Ofcom's abilities to do this. Just because I need to ask you about winter fuel today, especially with temperatures dropping. Just a quick thing here, which many are mooting, an Australian-style ban on social media for under-16s. Will you do that?
Everything is on the table with me.
What does that mean?
Well, what I want to do is look at the evidence. I'm also launching a feasibility study today to look at the areas where evidence is lacking. It is a frustration.
Don't we already know all of this? It's been done by several experts. We had one on earlier.
No, there are assumptions about the impact it has on children and young people, but there is no firm peer-reviewed evidence.
OK, so when you've got that, you will look at it. I'll tell you what we do have today is government numbers, government estimates, I should say. Temperatures dropping, new inflation figures showing gas, annual gas and electricity prices going up £149 last month. And these new government figures out from your government today show that your controversial decision to cut the winter fuel allowance will result in an additional 50,000 pensioners living in relative poverty. I should say the government has highlighted the estimates do not take into account its efforts to encourage more pensioners to apply for pension credit. While we don't know exactly how many more pensioners will be put into relative poverty by a Labour government's decisions, it will be thousands. How does that sit with you?
All of the decisions that we were forced to take because of the inheritance we had from the previous administration do not sit easily with me. We didn't come into office to do these things. We
I
do
also
so
like
with
this
a very
decision, though, as temperatures are dropping.
We do all of these tough decisions with a very heavy heart. But we also know that if we do not fix the foundations of our broken economy that we inherited from the predecessors, then these kinds of challenges will go on into the future indefinitely. By taking these difficult decisions, and I say this with humility for those people impacted by the decisions we've taken, that we will fix the foundations, we'll get the economy growing, and everybody will benefit
it,
into
it
the long term.
It doesn't sit easily with you. There's another question around sort of legislation voting at the moment that I just want to make sure I put to you before our time is up. The assisted dying bill comes to a vote next week. How will you vote?
I'm on the record because I voted for it in the previous iteration. My view hasn't changed, but I won't go into this because it's a free vote. Every MP needs to be able to make their own decisions. I will be making my own decision personally going into this, not on behalf of government.
So your vote will be...
My view on this hasn't changed since I voted for it in the previous iteration when it came before
because
Parliament.
Because the Cabinet Secretary has urged ministers not to take part in the public debate. Do you think that's the right decision? Do you not think we should actually have the widest debate possible? This could be monumental.
Well, because this is a decision for Parliament to take, we as individual MPs need to have this discussion from a parliamentary perspective. So we don't want a government to kind of weigh into it. We want this to be a discussion that we have on behalf of the public from a parliamentary perspective. I think that's the right decision. That's why I'm trying to avoid getting into the nitty-gritty of the debate itself.
Well, thank you.
But I do stand by the decision I took previously.
For answering based on that and saying your views haven't changed. Peter Kyle, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, thank you.
2 minutes to eight. What about the weather? Has it changed? Simon King.
Nick, no, it's still very cold, very frosty and icy in places this morning. Temperatures got down to -7 Celsius in parts of Northern England and Scotland last night. And we've had some further snow falling this morning as well. So that could lead on to some travel disruption. But let's have a look at the forecast in southwest and southeast England towards eastern England. Well, we've got a few showers in Cornwall and Devon at the moment. Otherwise, though, it is just cold and frosty to start off the day. A few areas of cloud, but we're going to see lots of sunshine for most of us into much of the day today, exception being the far east of England, where there'll be a bit more cloud later on with that, some winter showers, a bit of snow perhaps over higher ground for a time. And it's going to feel pretty chilly with maximum temperatures only 1 to 4 degrees Celsius. Add on the wind chill, colder than that, but locally about 6 to 8 degrees in the far southwest. Now for Wales and the Midlands, again, a widespread frost, temperatures down to -2, -5 degrees first thing. We've had some winter showers coming in across parts of North Wales and into the Midlands, snow over the higher ground, but even down to low levels as well for a time this morning. Those winter showers will retreat back into North Wales for the day today. Elsewhere, there'll be lots of sunshine, temperatures of 1 to 4 degrees. Now, for northwest and northeast England, icy start for the day. Lots of sunshine through the day, but some winter showers in northeast England. Snow over the higher ground, say, like the North York Moors, 1 to 4 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland and Scotland, again, cold and frosty. Snow continuing in northern, western and eastern Scotland today. Sunny spells elsewhere, 0 to 5 Celsius.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 20th of November. Good morning if you're just joining us. The headlines. The rate of inflation has risen to its highest level since April, driven by an increase in household energy bills. President Biden has agreed to provide Ukraine with anti-personnel landmines to halt advancing Russian troops in another reversal of defence policy. A new report says children as young as 11 in England are carrying knives because they fear being attacked. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The rate of inflation has risen to 2.3%, up from 1.7% in September, the sharpest month-on-month rise for 2 years. The Office for National Statistics said it had been driven up partly by the increase in the energy price cap, which meant higher costs for gas and electricity. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, acknowledged there was more to be done to ease pressures on families. Here's our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
The increase in the energy price cap was the big driving force behind this larger-than-expected uptick in the rate of inflation. Annual gas and electricity bills rose by about £149 last month, but prices are rising much more slowly than in recent years. There were falls in recreation and culture, including live music and theatre ticket prices, and the cost of raw materials continued to fall due to lower crude oil prices. Price rises are now running at 2.3%, just above the Bank of England's target of 2%. Most economists predict that it will hover around this level into next year, as the bank aims to keep gradually cutting interest rates. Rate setters have warned there could be upward pressure on inflation from higher employment costs, mainly in terms of wages, following last month's budget. Likewise, other external global factors, such as potential trade tariffs being proposed by Donald Trump, could add to inflation.
President Biden has approved the supply of anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine in another marked shift in policy in the final weeks of his time in office. Officials said Kiev had agreed not to use them in built-up areas. Washington had only just authorized the use of its long-range missiles to strike deep into Russia, which Ukraine has already deployed. Our North America correspondent John Sudworth reports from Washington.
A US official confirmed to the BBC that Ukraine would be supplied with what it's long been asking for, anti-personnel mines to impede the advance of Russian troops. It's a significant change in policy. 2 years ago, the Biden administration committed to limit the export of such weapons because of concerns about the long-lasting risk to civilian populations. The US official said the mines supplied would be non-persistent, meaning they're designed to degrade over much shorter timescales. The decision follows another big change, the permission to fire US-made missiles into Russia, which Ukraine acted upon almost immediately, striking an ammunition store some 70 miles outside its borders.
The man appointed as the UK's first border security commander has defended his role and expressed optimism that real progress can be made in stopping people smugglers. In his first broadcast interview since taking up the job in September, Martin Hewitt told this programme there was no simple answer to the problem, but the first step was to attack the smugglers' business model. Here's our Home and Legal correspondent Dominic Casciani.
The former police chief said the UK had to project its border beyond the English coast and northern France and take the fight to the organised crime gangs moving people and boats across Europe. He promised to chip away at the criminal business model until it was no longer profitable, a tactic used widely against organised crime. The former Conservative Home Secretary James Cleverly has accused Labour of making up a job that already existed, but Mr Hewitt said that the meetings he was now chairing, involving every relevant branch of government and law enforcement, were the first time they'd all been working collectively together. The government will soon unveil new powers to tackle smugglers, inspired by the fight against terrorism. It hopes that the new offences will, long term, make it harder and harder for gangs to operate.
You can hear the full interview with Martin Hewitt after 8:30. A new report says children in England as young as 11 are carrying knives because they feel unsafe. The joint study was carried out by Ofsted, the Care Quality Commission and the Police Fire and Probation Inspection Bodies. They also found that children with special educational needs and disabilities were disproportionately at risk of harm. Thomas McGill reports.
Inspectors looked at the experiences of hundreds of children and how local services responded to incidents of serious violence involving young people. They concluded that such violence was now widespread and that whole communities were affected. It also found the problem was far more far-reaching than many adults realised. The report said parents were very concerned for the safety of their children and that in some cases children said they carried knives in order to protect themselves. According to the report, inspectors in some areas were alarmed that children as young as 11 were regularly carrying knives. Despite some good practice being found, inspectors also identified examples where partnerships were consistently failing to identify serious violence.
The government has made clear it is prepared to make the online safety bill tougher if tech companies don't do enough to protect users of their platforms. The legislation comes into force fully next spring. The Technology Secretary, Peter Carr, says he wants the regulator Ofcom to be more assertive with firms and report back on what action has been taken. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Peter Kyle lists five key areas for Ofcom to prioritise. This includes collecting evidence that tech firms are embedding safety features such as age verification tools into their platforms designed to protect children and minimise the spread of illegal content and disinformation. But Ofcom itself will not safety test products before they're released. Mr. Kyle also calls for the regulator to be prepared to tackle emerging harms such as the rise of AI-generated material, and said he would consider strengthening the Online Safety Act in the future if he found it was needed. Some critics have argued that the current legislation does not go far enough.
A US envoy has said a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah could be within grasp. He has described talks between the two sides as very constructive. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
The US mediator Amos Hochstein has said there's a real opportunity to end the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, with gaps narrowing between the two sides. His latest talks in Beirut came after Hezbollah reportedly gave a positive response to a US draft proposal. This could see Israeli ground forces leave southern Lebanon and Hezbollah fighters pull back from the Israeli border, while more Lebanese army troops and UN peacekeepers would be sent to a buffer zone. Israel has said it will agree to a ceasefire in Lebanon if all its demands are met.
More than 1,900 people in the UK are taking legal action against the manufacturer of Johnson's baby powder, claiming repeated use caused their cancers. Lawyers bringing the legal claim say Johnson & Johnson's talcum powder contained traces of asbestos, which is known to cause cancer. It's the first time litigation has been brought against the company outside of the United States, where it has been sued repeatedly. Johnson & Johnson denies any link between its product and cancer. The government is reviewing the role of physician and anaesthesia associates in England because of mounting concern about their use in the NHS. The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, has said they're being asked to perform tasks they're not supposed to do, but those in the roles say the accusations are unfounded. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
There's been an increasingly heated debate about the role of physician associates, with claims they sometimes do work for which they're not qualified and put patients at risk. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has now launched an independent review. He said many physician associates provided great care, but there were legitimate concerns about transparency for patients. He said the review would establish the facts. The Doctors' Union, the BMA, said the government had accepted there were safety issues, and it added that the expansion of the PA workforce should immediately be put on hold.
The supermarket chain Lidl has reported annual sales of nearly £11 billion, up 17% on the previous year. Lidl's UK CEO, Ryan McDonnell, has told the BBC that the business was gearing up for a bumper Christmas, but that tax rises in the budget would add tens of millions of pounds to its costs. Here's our business correspondent, Emma Simpson.
Lidl is the fastest growing supermarket chain in the UK. Like other retailers, it's digesting the contents of the budget. In his first broadcast interview, UK boss Ryan McDonald told the BBC he'd no doubt there would be inflationary pressures in the grocery sector, given all the extra cost pressures firms were having to absorb, and that the government needed to review how they intended to inspire growth. Mr. McDonald said he was pressing on with his investment plans, with another 80 new stores opening over the next few months, followed by 40 in the next financial year.
Commuters are facing widespread disruption this morning because of heavy snowfall and ice in parts of the UK. A warning for ice remains in place for much of southern England, the Midlands and eastern Wales. The Met Office is advising vehicles could become stranded, power cuts may occur, and rural areas could be cut off.
We're broadcasting this morning from the biggest border crossing in Europe, Capitan Andrevo, the main frontier between the EU and the world beyond. Turkey, Syria, Iran and Iraq, Georgia and Azerbaijan. Since we came on air, around 300 lorries, 500 cars have come through here. The numbers, three times that in the summer. A million lorries and almost 2 million cars cross each and every year. Now, which lorry, which car could be carrying migrants who want to make their way into Europe without papers? Which vehicle could be transporting the flimsy black rubber inflatables that can be crammed with 50 or more migrants on the channel but fold up to the size of a family suitcase? Boats, almost all of which, by the way, are manufactured across this border in Turkey. Those are questions for the border police and customs officers here. Questions they must answer as the Bulgarian government tries to prove that it is capable of controlling Europe's external frontier. Prove it, because that's what the EU demands, that's what the British government demands, that's why they're getting money from both. But proof of the limit of that ability, not just here but everywhere, comes at Bulgaria's biggest refugee camp.
in a town I visited less than an hour from here.
Hands up if you came here with a people smuggler and it was easy to get over the border from Turkey to Bulgaria. There's a lot of people nodding yes.
Yes,
you came. And it's easy?
Easy.
Not easy. You come over the fence.
Okay.
Over the ladder.
Yes.
And you have to pay a lot of money?
Yes.
Did you see the police?
هل شفتم شرطة؟
لا ما شفنا شرطة. No police. No police.
وجدنا بعض الكاميرات موجودة على الحدود.
They saw a few cameras in the woods, but the traffickers knew what to look for, where not to go, because they're very familiar with the area.
12 ساعة حتى.
Because they waited, for example, when the shifts changed overnight to cross and stuff like that, but the traffickers knew very well what they were doing.
الحرس حتى.
It's a crisp, beautiful morning, a blue sky over a disused military base. Barbed wire surrounds the walls here. The gates are as secure as if the tanks were still inside. It's home now to almost 1,000 migrants, Syrians in the main, who want to be refugees here in Bulgaria. There's more than 230 children, 100 of them unaccompanied. This, their home, not just for the odd day or week, but sometimes for many months, occasionally for a few years.
How are you?
I'm Nick. Good to meet you.
Izzet.
You speak any English, Izzet?
Arabic. Turk.
Which football team? United, Chelsea,
Real Madrid.
Arsenal,
Real Madrid.
And Real Madrid.
Real Madrid. اسمي عمر جيت من من سوريا من
قامشلي. My name is Omar. I come from Qamishli in Syria. I went through Turkey to reach Bulgaria. It was a very difficult journey. He is a minor, so he's 17 years old. It was very difficult for him to collect all the money to pay the smugglers that he used. They walked for 3 days when they were in Syria. Then once they got to Turkey, they were driven to the northern part of Turkey, but then they had to walk for 2 days in forests until they got to the Bulgarian border. Then they climbed over the fence, and then they walked for another 2 days in Bulgaria.
When you were near the fence, did you see the police?
So he says he didn't see any police, any border police, and they just walked, and the smugglers just knew where to take them.
What's going on inside Bulgaria's refugee camps is not something the government here want you to focus on. They instead want you to look at what's happening at the busiest land border in Europe, the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, between the EU and the wider world. They want to show off the efforts they're making to catch the people hidden in the backs of lorries, to catch the boats carried on lorries across that border. And why do they want to show that off? Because of the prize on offer. Membership of Schengen, the borderless zone of the EU, and the riches that could follow.
Valeri.
Yes. And your job is?
I'm a crew leader. I'm responsible almost for everything.
Our first guide here at Capitan Andreevo, the busiest border crossing in Europe, is Valeri Stoykov, a customs officer, and his dog, a British train dog.
Her name is Adele.
Can she sing like Adele?
No, we are just trying to make her sing like Adele, but we are not on that stage of training.
So she can't sing. What can she do?
She can do almost everything, but her main job is to sniff boats, to sniff rubber.
Let's see what Adele can do.
Okay, let's do it.
Not only is Adele a beautiful dog, it's got a rather beautiful harness with a Bulgarian flag, but also the Union Jack, to tell you who's paying for the treats she's being fed now.
What we did, we hired 2 pieces of rubber on the bus and the truck here. He's showing some of the parts of the minibus, and she's sniffing right now, okay? There is nothing on the right side of the minibus. Adele continues to sniff. Now she stopped on the place where the rubber was hidden, and she found the rubber.
So the rubber that's in this sample that Adele has just found have been cut from boats that were found in the UK. They were found on the English shore. So they cut these bits of those boats and they send them here so that they can train the dog with them.
What's interesting is that the bit of rubber is tiny. It's not like a huge boat. There's a tiny bit of rubber in a little plastic tube the size of a medicine pill box, which has been hidden inside the van.
That's why it's very important that they train the dog to be able to find even the smallest amount of smell, so that the dog can sense even tiny little bit of smell. And the purpose is exactly that they find more boats.
So this is a boat that you seized?
Yes. We detained 113 boats like this.
So let's take a look at this. This is an inflatable, which is what?
Like 15 meters.
And it's very crude, isn't it?
Yes.
This is just a very simple inflatable rib. And at the back, an engine, what, 30 horsepower?
Yes.
Which you would use on the back of a craft for two or three people in Britain. And this will take how many?
I guess more than 50. In an SUV, we found four boats like this.
But what happens if the person with the boat says to your officer, I like fishing, I have some boats to go fishing. Mm-hmm. How do you know I'm a people smuggler?
That's why Bulgaria changed the law, and there are just exporters from Turkey who are approved.
If I don't have a license, I have already broken the law.
Sure, sure. And we'll confiscate the boat.
Even though I've seen images of these boats hundreds of times, there is something actually rather shocking about just walking along this craft. It is so flimsy. If you're lucky, it would get you to Britain. If you're unlucky, it would take you to your death. So Bulgaria changed the law so that it is harder to bring these boats and life jackets and engines. But if I only get a fine, maybe I just try again next week, and the week after that, and the week after that. If I make a lot of money from people smuggling, I can pay any number of 2,000 euro fines.
That's for sure. Nobody says we stop everything here, but we tried hard.
The chief of the border police here, the man in charge of the hundreds of officers trying to intercept the people smugglers, the migrants and the boats, is a man called Yanni Bechev. He shows me the technology, the techniques they use to find what the smugglers would rather stay hidden.
So these
are lorries coming from Turkey into Bulgaria. So he's using a device that is called a gas analyzer. So this device here, as you can see on the screen, is detecting the presence of carbon dioxide inside the lorry. If it's above a certain level, then there is a living organism inside the vehicle.
So the officer here has like a long metal wand, a few feet long, and attached to it is a screen a little bit bigger than a normal mobile phone. The wand goes up inside the skin of the lorry and is detecting carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a sort of detector for people.
Yeah, for oxygen.
You talk of the success here in protecting this border from the people smugglers, but there is also corruption, people paying officials to get across borders. There are other problems that you have to deal with.
It is true that there are problems with corruption and bribes when it comes to officers working guarding the border. That's why they take very serious measures and they're very efficient. Like, for example, the officers change their posts every 3 months so they don't stay in one place for too long. And also within every 12-hour shift, they change their desks, their workspaces, four times within a 12-hour shift. And this way, no one knows when where they're going to be at a certain point in their shift.
Back at Harmonly Reception Centre, Bulgaria's biggest refugee camp, is a reminder that for all the talk of fences and border police, of sniffer dogs and clever bits of machinery, in the end what migration is about is desperate people willing to do desperate things to escape desperate situations. This place is home to people who've done just that. Amongst them, Radwan, a Syrian, who made it across the border just 2 months ago.
He says all the governments in Europe are aware that the smugglers are at work and they know this is happening and it will continue to happen. Whatever they say they're doing, the migrants won't stop coming.
So Radwan, this keeps happening because you don't want to go home to Syria.
No, Syria.
Nothing will stop because all the dogs are still there. Everyone is there still fighting.
Syria. الجميع روسيا ايران حزب الله الصين امريكا
Hezbollah, the United States, the EU, the French, the Chinese, everyone is still there and they're fighting.
سوريا اتمنى توقف الحروب في جميع العالم.
We hope that the war gets stopped and ends. And the world becomes a more peaceful place.
No one who works with migrants, with people who want to be refugees, no one who works on border security ever uses the sort of language you read routinely on social media, and occasionally politicians turn into slogans. Not for them the promises to stop the boats or smash the gangs. They talk instead about much more modest ambitions, trying to make journeys harder so that fewer people try, trying to frustrate the people smugglers. They all accept that those who really want to make it from one side of the border to the other will probably eventually succeed. Now we're going to be discussing what we've been exploring on the programme this week, straight after today at 9 o'clock on a special live recording of the Today podcast. You can listen seamlessly on BBC Sounds if you go to the live stream on BBC Sounds, and indeed you can pose a question if you want to put one to Amol or to me at +44 330 123 4346, or you can email us today@bbc.co.uk.
It's 23 minutes past eight. Now, coming back to the UK and perhaps where you are this morning, I don't know how it is, but you might have woken up and thought that sort of moment of peeking out the window, knowing that temperatures are dropping. Is there any snow? Any ice? Have you got to deal maybe with the car or what the journey's like wherever you're going? You might be worrying about it. There might also be some feelings of excitement. After this winter's first snowfall, then, Sir Michael Morpurgo, the award-winning writer and former Children's Laureate, wrote a poem, especially for us, for you, about that special moment.
Write a poem about yesterday's snow, she says. Maybe you were playing in it on the way to school. Maybe you went on the snow slide in the playground. Your noses and your fingers were all frozen. Think about the snowman you built, she says. The snowball fights you had in the park, maybe on the way home, rolling down that hill, all the fun of it. Write a poem about the snow. So I did. Here it is, in my bad English. But I've got an excuse, miss. Together. My dad messaged me. He does it when he can. He told me it's snowing where he is too. We can't play in it, he says, and that makes him sad, not because of the war, because when he sees snow these days, he thinks of me and Mama, of the snowman we built at home before, of the sledding we did before, the snowball fights we had before, or the freezing hands we had before, the cold noses and feet we had before, of the snow you dropped down my neck. It makes him think of how the world was before, how he was, how you were, Mama was, how we all were before. Together, we were together, remember? Our last winter together, we had snow, remember? Snow upon snow on Christmas Day, remember? Together. It's my favourite word. No, snow is not my favourite word. because we are not together. I saw on my phone you had snow in Scotland. Not together again for another winter. So snow makes me sad. Makes me and Mama sad too, Tato. Walking to school, playing in the playground, all is laughter and fun. But I cannot feel laughter. I cannot feel fun. I want to, but I can't. Not without you, Dad. Not without my Tato. But if I see you in snow, he says on his phone, it would make me smile. I need to smile. It would warm my fingers, warm my toes, warm my heart. So it was my idea, my poem, sort of, to Tato in his trench. A photo of me and Mama outside our front door with our snowman, in Tato's hat, with holly for his ears and stones for his eyes, his face smiling. We made the smile with our fingers and our thumbs. He messaged, not sad anymore, made me smile. We are together for a moment. We will be together forever.
Sir Michael Morpurgo, thank you for that poem, especially for us, especially for you, on the first snow. Mike is here with the sport at 27 minutes past eight.
Emma, thank you. Good morning. Despite speculation to the contrary, Pep Guardiola has signed a contract extension as manager of Manchester City. The Spaniard, who's won six Premier League titles in 8 years at City, was set to see his current contract expire at the end of this season, but has now signed a new 12-month deal, although the club, as yet, are refusing to comment. Meanwhile, Wales are celebrating a surprise promotion to the top tier of European football's Nations League. They came from behind last night to beat Iceland 4-1 in Cardiff. We, though, are going to talk athletics now and an event that's being described as the dirtiest race in history.
It's going to be a very, very hard run for home. Jamal is charging hard for the take. Oh, it is. It's going to be Turkey 1 and 2. What about that? Altekin first. And in second place is Bulut coming through very, very strongly in the end. What about that for a race?
Well, that was the finish of the women's 1500 metres at London 2012, a race that has been described as the dirtiest in history, even dirtier than Ben Johnson's discredited 100 metres gold at Seoul 1988. Of the 12 runners who finished the race in London, five of them have subsequently gone on to be banned for doping violations. The latest is Russian middle distance runner Tatiana Tomashova, who was confirmed yesterday to have been stripped of the silver she won in that event, a medal she only had in the first place after the original winners of the gold and silver medals were also stripped of their titles due to doping. Well, as a result of all these disqualifications, the British athletes Lisa Dobrisky and Laura Waitman, who finished 10th and 11th in the race respectively, will now officially be placed 5th and 6th. I'm delighted to say that Laura Waitman joins us now for her first interview since this news was confirmed. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
So what is your reaction to this latest disqualification, this latest sorry tale in this now thoroughly discredited race?
It's obviously news that wasn't totally unexpected, given that we were aware a couple of months ago that this news was potentially to come as they were looking to reallocate the medals. And given that Tomashova had a previous anti-doping rule violation ban back in 2009. So it's incredibly frustrating that we are still at this point where a number of athletes have been disqualified from this race. But it's really reassuring in many ways that the sport isn't giving up on clean athletes who compete and train hard throughout their whole careers for their performances on these global stage championship. So it is highlighting the importance of clean sport and the testing that goes in even all these years later. But it's just really, really disappointing that we're still in this position, which over 10 years later, there's another athlete who has been banned. And I think we're now up to, what, 6 or 7 left in the race now of the 13 on the start line.
Your teammate, Lisa Dobrisky, who, like you, has now also been elevated up to a fifth place finish in this race, spoke out immediately after that race, almost, didn't she, 12 years ago, telling the BBC she didn't feel that she had competed on an even playing field. I wonder, did you also have suspicions at the time, maybe voiced privately?
Yes, it was one of those that Lisa and I were at very different stages of her career at that time. And Lisa was coming into the Olympic Games, having won an incredible medal at the World Championships in 2009, was in the shape of her life. And I really believed was an athlete who was there in a position to potentially medal at those games, had the race been a level playing field and been run in a very different way, because it was much different tactically to what you might see on the global stage now. It was a much slower tactical race. Whereas myself, it was my first global championships. I was representing my country at a home Olympic Games. Everything was so new to me. I'd only had a few early experiences of anti-doping tests, and even then I was still aware that something wasn't quite right, but I never imagined it would be to the extent that it has been revealed to be today. So, you know, Lisa speaking out afterwards really did speak up for clean sport and really did speak up for what she saw.
Yeah, she's been completely vindicated, hasn't she? The Guardian, Laura, reported a few years ago that there were 116 failed drugs tests at the whole of London 2012. How much does that taint the legacy of our home games, do you think? An event that all of us rightly still look back on incredibly fondly.
I think that highlights the part of a global problem that anti-doping in sport has been for a number of years, and the authorities are moving forwards and are continuing to retest, and this result and reallocation of medals does show that. For me, I feel so fortunate that I had such a positive experience at the London Games, despite these results and despite the number of anti-doping violations that did occur. I feel so lucky that I got to represent my country at home Olympic Games and loved absolutely every second of competing for my country, and knowing that I was doing it for clean athletes and for clean sport. So I feel really proud of that performance, and I'm hopeful and that the sport will continue to fight for clean athletes, and athletes will not get away with cheating and breaking the rules.
Yeah, as you say, I guess in some senses the authorities should be applauded for retrospectively going after these cheats even over a decade after the original event. As a final point, Laura, as you touch on, 12 years on from London 2012, do you believe in your heart of hearts that athletics is an even cleaner sport now than it was at in the London Games? Are you confident that the athletes we saw, say, at this summer's Games in Paris were completely clean?
I think there's a lot of work to do. The sport is moving in the right direction. We're seeing more and more athletes being sanctioned, more and more tests happening, more and more investment. And that's all that we can do at the moment, is keep driving that investment, driving that conversation about clean sport, letting cheats know that they won't get away with it. They will be caught, and clean sport will be rewarded. It is frustrating that it takes this long, but unfortunately, when people are competing for money, for medals, it's unfortunately in life people are going to cheat and take the shortcut. But I just really hope that the sport keeps pushing forward and over time drives forward the message of clean sport, that you will be caught and you won't get away with it.
Well, it's fantastic to get your reaction to that this morning. Laura Waitman, many thanks for joining us on the programme, and congratulations on your new elevated sixth place finish in the women's 1500 metres from London 2012.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. Just after nine this morning, Dr. Sean Williams has another life-changing story.
Hello. Today, my guest is a sporting phoenix. As a 12-year-old English boy, he found himself alone, isolated from his mother in the Skid Row district of Los Angeles, with no ID, no money, no phone, just a black bin bag full of clothes. What he did at that moment of crisis and what happened to him in the week that followed would lead eventually to him representing his country at basketball. It's an extraordinary story of transformation. That's Life Changing on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds in half an hour.
Thank you, Sean. Quick look at the weather today. Blustery snow showers for far northern Scotland. For most of the rest of us, dry and bright.
Oh, right, at 25 tonight, let's remind you, you're listening to Nick Robinson, where he's told me it's blue sky in Bulgaria, so we're jealous, and Emma Barnett here in London. And now we have Jane Steele here with a summary of the news.
The rate of inflation has risen to its highest level since April, climbing to 2.3% last month from 1.7% in September, the sharpest month-on-month rise for 2 years. The Office for National Statistics said it had been driven up partly by the increase in the energy price cap, which meant higher costs for gas and electricity. President Biden has agreed to give Ukraine anti-personnel landmines only days after allowing Kyiv to strike targets inside Russia with American-supplied missiles.
US officials say Ukraine has pledged to use the mines in its own territory and not in built-up areas. A new report says children as young as 11 in England are carrying knives because they feel unsafe. The joint study was carried out by Ofsted, the Care Quality Commission and police, fire and probation inspectant bodies. They also found that children with special educational needs and disabilities were disproportionately at risk of serious youth violence. Commuters are facing disruption this morning because of heavy snowfall and ice in parts of the UK. A warning for ice remains in place for much of southern England, the Midlands and eastern Wales.
Jane, thanks very much. It's 24 minutes to nine. Shame must change sides. When you are raped, there is shame, and it is not for us to have shame, it is for them. Those are the words of Gisèle Pelicot, the French woman drugged by her ex-husband so she could be raped and sexually abused by him and dozens of other men. Yesterday, the closing arguments were made in a trial that has rocked France and been followed around the world. Not just for the scale of the abuse, which her ex-husband has admitted, but also the fact that he shared the dock with 49 other men. And for the fact that Gisèle has insisted the whole way through of having total openness and waiving her right to be anonymous. Gisèle's daughter, Caroline, has also testified at that trial, telling the court that she believes she had also been abused by her father. A verdict is expected from a panel of five judges on the 20th of December. Cynthia Illouz is a journalist and founder of The Women's Voices, a digital platform dedicated to amplifying the voices of women in the public sphere, and she attended the court yesterday. When we spoke a bit earlier, I started by asking whether this trial could be, is, a watershed moment in France.
Absolutely. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a really game changer in justice, because we were all able to observe the problematic of rape culture in France, but I think it's a worldwide problem also. Yesterday, we hear from Dominique Pelicot himself try to explain itself. And we also heard about Gisèle Pelicot in the courtyard. She mentioned that this trial is the trial of cowardice, because all the accused men, the defendants, they are all denying the rape, saying that Dominique Pelicot is the great mastermind of all of this, and they were not really agree to commit the sexual assault on Gisèle Pelicot. And I think another phenomenon is that the men are involved for the first time. I mean, usually in society, it's more feminists that are talking about the different rapes, feminicide, you know. And for the first time, men think they are involved in that because of the number of the accused men and a different profile of them.
So are you saying men in France are talking about this?
Yes, yes, for the first time, you know, they're coming also to the protests. They really realize that we are living in a patriarchal society, and that is a big urgence to change.
I mean, some would say that this is an extraordinary case with a man drugging and raping and asking other men to come and other men doing that. So that's what's been alleged here. What do you think this says to men across France?
The first things in they can wonder this question, do I know someone who is capable of doing that? You know, so many men are involved in this case, and you know, Mazan is not a big city in France. It's a very small village. So if Dominique Pelicot found so many men ready to come to his house, for sure it says a lot about all the men that are around us on a daily basis. So for the first time, they are asking themselves those questions. If I am invited to such a thing in online, because you know, maybe the thing that they all have in common is that they met online and they are completely addicted to pornography, but violent pornography. And also, you mentioned it, what is really interesting is to discover the phenomenon of chemical submission that we don't really know anything in France. We were just hearing about, you know, know, some drug in bar, but it's a small topic and now it's beginning a huge topic.
You mentioned rape culture at the beginning of our discussion.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
It's a culture that allow men to talk to women or to think to women as objects. This is something that you can see in the culture, in the cinema, in movies, even in advertising. So this is something that allow men to be not respectful with women and allow them to be violent. And also probably I want to mention that here in France, more than 80% of women, when they are charging for rape, are discharged. So there's no trial after that. And there's only 1% of cases that are finishing by a real sentence of a prison for the man.
In a month's time, we will know the sentence in this case. Yeah. The final statements were yesterday. Do you think then that this is a moment France might reappraise itself?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a kind of unity between women, because in some point, this is something that we all experience on a different level. We're talking about, you know, the continuum of violence from sexual harassment in the public area, in transportation, to different kind of sexual assault in our life. So this is something that gathers everyone here in France is talking about this trial, you know, taxi driver, a man in bars. Everyone is really following what's happening in the trial, because every day we are discovering something new. There's a new development. And also what is profoundly shocking is the way lawyers are talking about the case. They're talking about Gisèle Pellico, you know, implying that she may be an accomplice to her ex-husband. So we really are all shocked about what's happening in this trial. Yeah.
Cynthia Illouz there.
It's 17 minutes to nine. We won't waste time and money on gimmicks, Keir Starmer declared when he scrapped Conservative plans to deport migrants who arrive here across the channel to Rwanda. He promised instead to deploy all the resource and tactics of law enforcement to combat the gangs that smuggle people. And he created a new role, a border security commander, to lead the battle to, in his words, smash those gangs. That job was itself dubbed a gimmick by Conservative critics. Well, I've been speaking to the man who's got it, the former senior police officer who's just started in post, Martin Hewitt, in his first broadcast interview as border security commander. I asked him whether what is really happening hundreds of miles away, like here, where I've been broadcasting from all this morning, Europe's biggest land border in Bulgaria, really affects his ability to bring securities to the borders back home.
One of the things that I've said pretty much from taking the job over 6 weeks ago is that if we're going to be successful here, we've got to project the border away from simply northern France and southern England. We know that small boat crossings are moving from their source country through many other countries, and it's absolutely critical if we're going to be successful for us to be projecting our activities into those countries and working really closely with the governments, with the law enforcement agencies in those countries, to stop people at the point well before they reach the northern coast of France.
The Bulgarians were keen to show to me, they've shown, I know, to British ministers in the past, what they're doing to intercept the boats coming across the border from Turkey. But in truth, a British-trained sniffer dog, some new €2,000 fines if you illegally import a boat, that's not going to make a dent, is it, in a multi-billion pound people smuggling business?
Well, as you say, these people smugglers, these are organised criminals who are in this purely to make money. And my role really is to do everything and use all the organisations that we've got and all the capability we've got to stop that. Now, you're quite right. I think those actions that you've spoken about are really helpful. And my view is very clearly there's not one simple answer that is going to solve this problem that's been around for some considerable time. It's about how we bring all of those things together. We are chipping away at their criminal business model. We are chipping away by seizing their equipment, by disrupting what they're trying to do. So it's a really important thing that the Bulgarians are doing with our assistance and the things that we're doing in other countries. But it's about how we bring the whole of the effort together to have the impact that we need to have to stop the boats coming across the channel.
Bulgaria has a reason to be seen to be helping. It wants to have freedom of movement within the EU. But other governments, the Germans, for example, there's no law against transporting boats in Germany. There's no law against storing them in Germany. Isn't the brutal truth that this problem is our problem, not theirs, and it's certainly not their priority?
No, I disagree completely with that. This problem is a problem for certainly every country in Europe, and I've spoken to senior German officials since I've taken over this role, and as you are probably, and your listeners are probably aware, I met with Italian officials when I was first appointed. So every country in Europe faces issues around migration. Now, clearly, we are focused on those migrants that are coming across the channel. But there is a real interest in all of those other countries to be in a position to control this activity. And as much as anything else, we are talking about organised crime. And it is no benefit to any country to have organised criminals operating in any way with impunity. So that's why one of the key things that I will be doing is working with all the countries from source countries through all the transit countries and working in the UK to attack this problem from all angles and have the conversations that allow us to be as effective as we can be.
Your job's a new one and it's got a pretty grand title, Border Security Commander, but you'll be well aware that there are some sceptics, including indeed the former Home Secretary, James Cleverly, who've suggested it's a grand-sounding title for a job that was already being done by somebody else.
Well, that's not correct. This job has never been done by anybody else. And what is different about the role that I now have, the Border Security Commander, me in the role that I have leading that, is for the first time having that ability to look across all of the agencies and organisations that we deploy to secure our borders. I had my first system leader meeting last week where we had 20 plus senior people from all different Home Office departments, from the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office, from the Ministry of Defence, and obviously National Crime Agency, Counterterrorism Policing, General Policing, Security Services. So all working collectively. This has not happened before, with one department, one unit and one person having the responsibility to cohere and to coordinate the system so that all of the effort that our people are deploying, both in the UK and internationally in all our embassies, is having the maximum impact by working together against a clear picture of what the intelligence is and working to undertake the operations that will give us the results that we need to deliver.
You're emphasising the complexity of this problem, the number of pieces of the jigsaw, if you like. What's your answer to those who say it's a lot simpler? Tear up our human rights commitments, turn back the boats in the middle of the channel, be prepared, yes, for a massive row, but send the signal you're not wanted here.
I think what I would say is that this is a global problem. The movement of people is a global problem, as we've already said, and if there was one simple answer that anyone could deploy that was actually a legitimate answer to deploy, then I think it would have already been done thus far. This is an incredibly complex and challenging problem. And my role is to bring together all of the pieces that we understand that we need to deliver to make an impact on that role. And that's what I'm going to do over the, you know, in the near future and in the coming years.
And given the continuing war in Ukraine, the widening war in the Middle East and climate change, isn't the likelihood there would be more people on the move, more people heading to the channel, not fewer?
I think that everyone would accept that the situation in the world at the moment inevitably leads you to think that there will be more people moving. And I would agree with that, which is even more of a reason, to my mind, why we need to, we've got a plan of how we are going to do what we need to do to impact on, particularly on the organised criminals that are delivering this particular trade, but also working collectively across all of government, both here and overseas, and working with other governments to find a solution that is a real and long-lasting solution to the problem.
You're border security commander now, but you were a senior police officer. Isn't the war, in inverted commas, on people smuggling rather like the war on drugs? It's a neat slogan, but it's never going to be won. That's simply not the reality.
I don't use terms like war in that context. My mission is very clear. We know that this is being facilitated by organised crime groups. I have plenty of experience of how you undermine and how you impact on organised crime groups. And we are going to be working collectively to do everything that we can to take away that business model, to lock people up where we can. And you will have seen, your listeners will have seen the arrest that happened last week by the National Crime Agency in the Netherlands, working with Belgian law enforcement officials as well, taking out a significant player in one of those groups. We will keep moving and we will keep chipping away and undermining their business to the point where that is no longer viable and no longer profitable. And that's the objective for what we're setting out to do.
Martin Hewitt, Border Security Commander, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks, Nick.
Now, later this morning, Rachel Stonehouse and Matthew Hill are exploring a series of scandals involving mothers and babies that has shaken some people's confidence in NHS maternity care. Some women are seeking alternate care, but is it safe? That is the subject of File on 4 this morning at 11. And straight after this programme, in about 8 minutes' time, Amol and I are going to be doing a special live recording of the Today podcast on the BBC Sounds Live news stream, where we're going to talk more, Amol, aren't we, about the issues raised in this week's reporting from Bulgaria and Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, look, first things first, I thought that was a hell of a package at 8:10, you and your team put together, Nick. If one of the purposes of foreign reporting is to try and bring the distant near, create really vivid images in the mind of our listeners, as I was coming in, I could not stop thinking about Adele the sniffer dog and that tiny bit of rubber. I mean, in the end, you know, politics, you know, you need slogans, but you can stand behind lecterns and say, stop the boats. In the end, the reality of politics and policy comes down to those tiny things where a dog in a distant land is trying to search out a tiny bit of rubber.
It is something to see, I have to say. Adele was rather impressive, but the scale of the task is what is really impresses you here, Amol. The sheer number of cars and lorries coming over this one border crossing and so many others means that to promise to stop the flow of people, let alone the boats themselves, is incredibly difficult to do. But we'll talk more about that, won't we, in response to people's questions.
Yeah, well, we've got lots of questions. There'll be more questions off the back of that interview with Martin Hewitt as well. And I should say that last time we conducted this experiment of this live podcast recording straight after the show, you might almost call it radio, Nick, it went very well indeed. Lots of people stayed on, and the way to find it is if you've got the BBC Sounds app, at the top of it there's a sort of dial with all the different stations, so Radio 1, Radio 1 Extra, Radio 2 and so on. We're there, and if you toggle it to the right, you'll see a circle that says Live News. Click on that, and this will be on that live news stream from 9 o'clock. That's all you've got to do. And do send us your questions. So the best way to get in touch is via WhatsApp. You can send us a message to +44 330 123 4346. That's +44 330 123 4346. Or you can email us on today@bbc.co.uk.
At 6 minutes to nine, just time to say that we are joined by a man widely considered the finest Australian novelist of his generation, Richard Flanagan, who's just been announced this year's Bailey Gifford Prize winner for non-fiction with his book Question 7, 10 years on from his winning of the Booker Prize for fiction with a previous book. That is a double win. He is the first author to do so. Just to tell you about this book, though, Question 7, according to the judges, was the unprecedented winner, part memoir, part history. The book charts Flanagan's attempt to understand his parents and Tasmania, where he's from, beginning at a love hotel by Japan's inland sea and ending by a river in Tasmania, and containing a story of a near-death experience, I believe you had, Richard. it's good to talk to you this morning. Richard Flanagan, hello.
It's lovely to be here.
Congratulations. I mean, I don't know how you probably process being the first to do that with that double win, but what's going through your mind on that?
I've been walking for 6 days in the Tasmanian wilderness, and so there's no completely off the grid. There's no connections, and I got off a few hours ago, and when we drove into the nearest town, that the phone started screeching like a chainsaw out of control, and the first message was a series of profanities from a friend, and I realised something had happened. Yeah, and then on it went. So, I haven't processed it, but I'm greatly honoured.
Well, congratulations again, and I've done a little of explaining it. You know, we don't want to say too much because people do like to go off and read. But there's also an interesting story of why, or one of the reasons which led you to write this, I believe, a mistaken diagnosis of early onset dementia.
Yes, that's true. It sharpens the mind. I was given a year and told to get my affairs in order, and I'd been wanting to write this book for some time but hadn't really found my way to it. And so I sort of wrote it in about 11 months and sent it to my editor of near 30 years and asked her, did it show signs of cognitive collapse? Because if it did, I didn't wish it to be published. And she just laughed and laughed. And then I went back to the neurologist and he agreed with her. And that was that. And it was a mistaken diagnosis, but it did help. It did help me write the book, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's something in itself to get through. I mean, people talk about motivation, deadlines, and reasons, but haven't heard that one. What was it though that made you want to write this? Not necessarily in that speed, but what was it from your personal life that was driving you towards this story?
Well, I guess that was part of it. I mean, why to live? What is it to live? Why does living matter? What matters in life? You know, I think we live in an age, we're always obsessed with timetables, with commitments, with work, but, you know, really what matters is this subterranean world of who we love, why we love, what is it to live? How do we, you know, what is it that ultimately matters? What answers do we make to the emptiness of the universe? And I thought more and more about my parents, and that, you know, I grew up in this little mining village, very remote in the wilderness of Tasmania, and the answer they made to the horrors of that island, which had closest to the, you know, the closest thing to a successful genocide in human history, which had a sort of white slave system that was called convictism. And they came from poor backgrounds. And the answer they made to that was to practice an idea of love, which when I was young, I thought somewhat naive, but they fought for that love and they practiced that love. And over decades, it became a truth and a reality. And it was, I think, a form of magic, and they, the magicians. And I wanted to write about how kindness and goodness matter so much, because it's not reducible to politics, it's not religion, but it is the answer we can make to the emptiness and despair that sometimes, you know, grabs hold of us.
So, you know, we could talk a lot longer than I have to go into that, but thank you for taking us there and what you were thinking about. And I have also read that you're not going to accept the prize money, the £50,000 prize money of the Baillie Gifford Prize, until there's a plan that you see for the fund to reduce its investment in fossil fuel extraction.
Look, I think, you know, I think Baillie Gifford have done a lot of good for literature in Britain. And I think to be respected and honoured for that,